Quality Sounds, there are podcasts to help you look after your body
and your mind.
From increasing your immunity
to feeling more confident.
Or tips on how to focus.
Sorry, what were you saying?
If it matters to you, it matters to us.
Feel good inside and out.
With What's Up Docs
and Complex with Kimberly Wilson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 10th of May. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. Keir Starmer has insisted he will lead Labour into the next general election, despite growing calls for him to step aside after the party's dropping in polls across England, Scotland and Wales. He's told The Observer newspaper that last week's results were very tough, but that his government was a 10-year project of renewal. The Prime Minister will use a speech tomorrow to try to win back support, but he could also face a challenge to his leadership. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The Prime Minister wants to get on the front foot after last Thursday's dismal electoral performance. He'll draw bold dividing lines with Reform UK by saying he won't hold back from seeking closer ties to Brussels, and that he expects to launch a scheme to allow young EU citizens to work temporarily in the UK and vice versa next year. He'll have to convince an increasingly sceptical Labour Party that he has the ideas and ability to improve its historically low poll ratings. Tomorrow is also the deadline set by the former minister Catherine West for leadership challenges to Sir Keir to step up, otherwise she'll launch her own bid.
The cruise ship hit by a deadly outbreak of hantavirus is due to arrive at the Spanish island of Tenerife this morning, where those on board will be allowed to disembark. The 22 British passengers and staff aboard the MV Hondius will be tested and taken back to the UK. They will isolate at the same hospital on Merseyside used as a quarantine site at the start of the COVID pandemic. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Tenerife.
The Hondius won't be allowed to come to shore here in Tenerife. The cruise ship will anchor out at sea instead so that people can then be ferried to land in small groups, then taken onto charter flights home from the airport. This is a complex operation involving more than two dozen countries. It'll be managed by medics and officials in protective masks. The head of the World Health Organization, who's overseeing things here, has told Spaniards he understands their concerns, stressing that the risk to the general population was low. The hantavirus is carried by rodents and not normally transmitted between people, but three died on the Hondius and several people have been infected.
Officials in Lebanon say 39 people were killed yesterday in a series of strikes by the Israeli military. The Israel Defense Forces said it had been targeting Hezbollah fighters. The group said it responded by launching rockets and drones into northern Israel. Israeli forces and Hezbollah have continued to trade fire since President Trump announced a ceasefire deal between the governments of Israel and Lebanon last month. Leaders of business organisations and religious groups have signed a letter telling the British Jewish community that they will do everything they can to protect it from anti-Semitism. Their commitment is in response to a number of attacks on British Jews and Jewish sites in recent weeks. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
Anti-Semitism is not a problem for Jewish people to have to respond to, says the letter. This is a problem for all of us to fix. The letter has been signed by religious leaders from the Muslim, Christian, Sikh and Hindu communities, by the Confederation of British Industry, the Football Association, Universities UK, ITV, The Guardian, the Local Government Association and others. The chief rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, said it was heartening to see so many stand against anti-Jewish hatred.
The Netflix drama Adolescence leads the way at tonight's television BAFTAs with six nominations. It's also up for the Memorable Moment Award, along with the Celebrity Traitors, which is chosen by a public vote. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimba looks at the ceremony.
I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder.
Adolescence's nominations include Best Actor for Stephen Graham.
I want you to tell me the truth.
And Best Supporting Actor for teenager Owen Cooper.
I just want to go home. I've not done anything.
While in the Best Actress in a Comedy category, three of the nominations are from Amandaland, Jennifer Saunders, Philippa Dunn and Lucy Punch. The Celebrity Traitors is nominated in Best Reality and in Best Entertainment Performance for its host, Claudia Winkleman. And BAFTA's highest honour, the Fellowship, will go to Dame Mary Berry.
The British boxer Daniel Dubois has won the WBO World Heavyweight title after beating his fellow Briton Fabio Wardley in Manchester. Dubois was knocked down twice during the fight but recovered to stop his opponent in the 11th round. It was Wardley's first professional defeat. The boxing promoter Frank Warren says it was a fantastic fight.
Two men bearing their hearts and souls in the ring, gave everything, didn't leave one bit outside the ring. It was just the most amazing fight, most amazing heavyweight fight either of them put on. It was just, I don't know, the shots they took, they were getting hit with bombs that would take people out, and they stood it.
BBC News.
Alan Smith, many thanks. This is BBC Radio 4. We discuss religion and tattoos next, later in an hour from now, as Sir David Attenborough turns 100. Our programme Sunday asks what his lifelong work revealing the natural world has meant, not just scientifically, but spiritually. Sunday is at 7:10. Let's hear about a new environmental series.
We're not getting waterfalls, we're not getting as many otters, we're not getting the swans that used to come on this island here.
What has happened to our rivers?
It's like sewage water, isn't it?
I'm Kate Lamble, and in a new 10-part series, I'll be hearing how two neighbours exposed a malodorous scandal and took on those responsible.
You can't do this legitimately, can you?
Investigating a centuries-old battle between public good and private profit.
It's not right.
Rinsed on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting this Monday to Friday at 1:45.
Time now for Beyond Belief.
So I got the Jerusalem cross. It's a Christian tattoo. That's the main meaning of it. I think most people just get tattoos because they look cool, and that's kind of the foundation of what every tattoo is for. And this one looks cool, and it's the oldest stamp that they have in their collection. I'm a Christian, and this is a Christian pilgrimage site, and so I thought this place would be perfect to get a tattoo. Mm-hmm. I liked the idea of coming to the what is recognized as the world's oldest tattoo shop and being able to use one of the stamps that's centuries old.
I like to get a tattoo to remind myself of all the different vacations we go on, so I thought it was a cool place, kind of unforgettable place to get one done. I got the Angel of the Apocalypse as one of their stamp tattoos out of the design book they have in there. Just kind of looked through, and that was the one that spoke to me.
And why did you get this tattoo? Like, does it have any religious significance to you, or is it only a memory of Jerusalem?
More of a memory than religious significance for me. Definitely happy with it. It's uncomfortable in the moment, but temporary pain that's worth it for the permanent reminder.
That was in the Razouk tattoo shop in central Jerusalem. When my oldest daughter was a teenager, my beautiful eldest daughter, she came home one day with a tattoo and I wasn't best pleased. That is, until I saw it. She had the words, "What seest thou else?" inked on her arm. They're words from Prospero to his daughter, words that I've actually often preached about and words that express the need to look beyond appearances. And I was totally won over. Tattoos are no longer the preserve of sailors and the Yakuza. They're often an expression of one's deepest convictions, even faith. David Beckham, of course, has an angel and a cross on his back. Yet some people of faith do think they're wrong, that the body is a temple, that the Bible prohibits them. This is Razouk Tattoos in Jerusalem.
My name is Wasim Razouk, and I come from the Razouk family that has been doing tattoos for the past 700 years. We are located in the Christian quarter in the old city of Jerusalem. So we are a Coptic Christian family that has been doing tattoos for Christians in Egypt for Christian Copts, because it's a tradition for Christians in Egypt to get a cross tattoo on the wrist so that they can distinguish each other and mark themselves with the cross. And then when my family came 500 years ago to the Holy Land on pilgrimage, there was a tradition of pilgrimage, Christian pilgrimage tattooing in the Holy Land that already had existed, and so they decided to stay here and tattoo pilgrims instead of tattooing Copts. For that reason, we are now here for the past 500 years, continuing a tradition that has started more than 1,000 years ago. There were more tattooers years that we're doing this tradition. The tradition has its own significance. It's not for decoration. The tattoos that we do, they symbolize faith. They symbolize Christians being reborn in their faith once they come to Jerusalem. But also, we tattoo people and give them the means to talk about their faith, to talk about their cross, and to spread the word of God. What we are doing is not just regular tattoo or, you know, beautifying somebody's arm with colorful designs or whatever.
So today, to help me get under the skin of the spiritual side of tattooing, sorry about that, I'm joined by Reverend Wendy Dalrymple, who's Canon of Ripon Cathedral. Welcome to you.
Hi, Giles. It's great to be with you.
Very nice to have you here. And Te Rangitau Netana, who's a Maori, who's up very late, and you're a practitioner of tamoko, which is traditional art of Maori tattooing. Is that right?
Yes. Kia ora tātou. Nice to be here.
I'm looking forward to talking to you more about that. And Gabby Wolf, who's a tattoo artist and host of the Hebrew Tattoos podcast. And your tattoo studio specialises in Hebrew calligraphy. Welcome, Gabby.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sounds really, really interesting. So, Wendy, on the train up here, you very kindly wore a short sleeve shirt for us so we can see your fabulous tattoos, and you've got your dog collar on as well. So people get into conversation with you.
They do. Yeah, this really works well for radio, Giles. This is good. But I thought I'm just going to enter into this. I'm going to get my arms out. And yeah, I had the "Are you really a reverend?" conversation, I think, three times on the train.
Which three times?
Three times, three different people.
And you've also got a Razook tattoo.
I do have the Jerusalem cross.
I'm so jealous.
And it's amazing. So they give you a stamp that they say is 500 years old and you should never ruin a good story with the truth. So I lent into that. And I'm sure it is the provenance of that tattoo parlour, you know, is amazing. And there was an amazing couple in their 70s in there at the same time as me from America. And they were kind of, I think one of them was recovering from cancer, and they were saying, "Our kids are not going to believe that we're doing this."
What, for the first time?
Yeah, they'd never had a tattoo before. But bless her, the woman I was talking to, she was having a tattoo on her wrist that was something around maybe an olive leaf, you know, a mark of peace, right, because she said, "The way things are going, I want to be able to extend a hand to a stranger and it be a mark of peace."
Oh, so, that's very beautiful. I don't have any tattoos. People talk about regret and tattoos. My regret is I've never had one, actually.
You're never too old, Charles.
Well, maybe that's right. Those ones in Razook, they have the great George and the Dragon ones, yeah, which I'd quite like. Te Rangitau, can you talk to me about your tattoos and where you have them?
Pretty much most of my body, from my feet top to the bottom. Most prestigious places, my face.
Can you talk to me a little about the sort of spiritual practice of tattooing in Maori culture?
For the beginnings of our traditions of tattooing, for us, we would say from the beginning of time, we have different atua or gods. Probably we have 72 gods, and the youngest of those is god of earthquake and volcano. And so he becomes involved in tattooing within the meaning of his name. So his name is Ruomoko. Ru is when the earth shakes. O is when the volcano erupts, and moko is when the lava flows and scars the earth. And so ru is also when we're tapping with traditional tools, it's the shaking of the skin and the breaking of the skin. Then the o is when the blood is also born from the skin, and then when we wipe the ink and the blood away, kind of thing, you're left with the scar. So then you have, so it's the intricacy is even goes right into the ink itself and how it's made, where it comes from, what it represents. And then, of course, the tools that you make, traditional tools and the materials you make of it, it's kind of, for us, is our lineage. It's our whakapapa. And so our ties to the land, to the tools, to connect ourselves to our ancestors.
You talk about scars there. I mean, there are a lot of scars in Maori culture with the sort of colonialism and all of that sort of stuff. Is there a connection there?
I guess when colonisation came, they tried to take that away from us, mainly Christian kind of churches and things like that, banned traditional tattooing right through the islands.
Wow.
So it's somewhat now reaffirming our traditions and empowering ourselves with reclaiming our traditions, kind of thing. So there's a renaissance of not just our traditional tattooing, but our languages and our culture, our dance, because it's all connected.
Gabby, can I bring you in this? I don't know if you've got tattoos, but I imagine you probably have.
Yes, I do. I got tattoos. I got my first tattoo when I was 18 and in prison, but since then I kind of didn't stop getting tattooed.
Right.
I think the main difference between how I perceive tattoos and how Wendy and Rangito perceive tattoos is that in Judaism, there is no tradition whatsoever of tattooing. On the contrary, it's prohibited. So everything is new land. Everything is an attempt to find something and connect it to roots. But of course, we don't have these roots within tattooing. We have to find them outside of tattooing. So what I do is calligraphy, because letters, they have roots in Judaism. Those roots are deep.
Of course, when you think about tattooing and Judaism, one of the first things that I would think about was Auschwitz and the numbers that people had tattooed by the Nazis on their wrists or their forearms. Does that come up a lot in conversation?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the main reasons why Jews don't get tattooed. I mean, it's prohibited by religious law. That's true, and that's important. But there are so many prohibitions in Jewish law that nobody cares about anymore. I don't know. You're not supposed to buy land. But it's not like Jews don't have land, and you're not supposed to mix linen and wool. But nobody cares. But tattooing is like, you know, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Auschwitz is part of that reason, definitely.
Yeah.
And it comes up time and again. I have a lot of clients who are 70, 80, and they get tattooed now because their parents, who were in Auschwitz, died. And then they felt liberated and like ready to get tattoos. Or who are 40 and their grandparents died. So Auschwitz is always there. It's very present, very central when we talk about Jewish tattooing.
And what sort of stuff do you mostly... it's letters. Words, are they from Hebrew scriptures? Are they from poetry? What are the sort of words that you often...
Yes. Hebrew scriptures, of course, a lot. Biblical verses, but then a lot of mysticism, a lot of mystic texts.
Okay.
In Jewish mysticism, letters play a central role there. So a lot of texts that deal with letters and the act of creation with letters. But then as well, Israeli poetry.
Names. Oh, so I've always wanted, if I was going to get a tattoo, it would actually probably be some words from Israeli poetry, actually. Wendy, can I return to you? There is a tattoo shop in Stoke-on-Trent, which is not that far from here, called Ink Our Nation. So obviously it's a sort of classic pun, but actually there's something about the incarnation that is actually rather important.
Yeah, so central to the Christian faith is the incarnation, the idea that God, the divinity, inhabits human flesh. So the idea that God honours, hallows all flesh and makes it holy, that's kind of central. So in terms of how I express that through my tattoos, a little bit, is I have a piece to the incarnation on my front left forearm. I have a uterus, actually. But
and you've got a cross in the middle, which is obviously a sort of like the incarnation.
Yeah.
Like...
So, and then the symbol for the Holy Spirit, the dove, is actually perched on the fallopian tube with a nice bit of detail that my tattoo artist worked in. And then there's a symbol for the lily, symbolic for Mary, red rose for Jesus. It's a piece, it's like an icon or like a stained glass window. And for me, this is, you know, this is central to my faith, and having it on my arm is as an expression of that.
Tiranitu, does that sense of physicality that Wendy's just talked about and the importance of physicality, does that play an important role in sort of Maori traditions of tattooing?
Sure. For us, it could be seen that pain is, I guess, the birthing process. So as I was saying, the god of tattooing being the youngest, when you go through receiving muko, different levels of muko as well, depending on the placement of the body. But as you go through, probably the highest one would be the face, it being quite painful. You're going through that pain at you're the only one that can kind of deal with it, really, you know, kind of thing. So it's connecting yourself to yourself. It's not only that, but, you know, the patterns and your family are involved. So people are reciting lineage. or they'll sing songs and stuff that are to do with your tribal connections, and they imbue those things, those memories, those words into the pain. When you're going through pain, you're in a heightened kind of position, like a baby kind of thing, and you kind of can suck in the negative or the positive. So we try to keep a positive atmosphere while we're working.
It sounds quite vulnerable when you're being tattooed on your face. That sounds like what you're saying.
For sure it is.
And yet I imagine people might also be quite frightened of a face that's tattooed. I imagine some people might have that reaction.
I guess that's the great thing about tattoos, you know, softens the bullshit out from the people that want to talk to you and the people that don't want to talk to you, you know. Yeah. So that's pretty great.
Excellent. I'm sure that's correct as well. One of the texts in the Bible that speaks specifically about tattoos and prohibits them is from the book of Leviticus chapter 19. And here is Wasim in Jerusalem talking about that text.
This verse came because the ancient Canaanites used to burn the dead and take their ashes and cut their flesh and put the ashes of the dead in their skin to glorify the dead. God came and said that you shall not mark your body for the dead. I am your God. Because they were marking their bodies with the ashes of the dead, glorifying them as God. And that's when God said, you cannot do this. If somebody is getting a tattoo to glorify the dead, and especially using the ashes of the dead, which even nowadays people ask for it. Sometimes they come with the ashes and they say, can you put this in the ink? I say no, of course, because that is against the Bible. But for Christians in the New Testament, it is not forbidden for Christians to get a tattoo, as long as it's a tattoo that glorifies God and that is a tattoo about the person's faith. And if you want, you can beautify your body as well. So as long as you're happy with your body and you're not doing anything that opposes God, for Christians, getting a tattoo is absolutely fine.
Reverend Wendy, Leviticus, you must have been asked about this a lot.
Occasionally, someone once did ask me, oh, Wendy, so were your tattoos from before you were saved? And yeah, you always have to read the scriptures, understanding the cultural context of the time, the cultural context of our own day. Gabby put it really well earlier, you know, there's an awful lot of ancient texts that would have us doing all sorts of things. I mean, I don't cover my hair. You know, you could proof text that out of the scriptures. So, I mean, to be honest, the abuse I get more is just that sort of got its roots in sort of straightforward sort of misogyny stuff, you know. Yeah. And again, that's something about women taking up space, you know, being proud of my body. I mean, I love my tattoos. They are for me.
There's another thing about tattoos that I've been reflecting upon, which is when we're at Vickers Training College, they talk about being a priest as being something that's indelible. Like the marks that you have on your body, you can't escape them. Yeah. It's a sort of absolute commitment, isn't it? To, you know, if I have Chelsea Football Club on my arm, I can't suddenly become a City fan tomorrow. So
no, it would be awkward. Yeah. Do you know, I hadn't thought of that before. And actually, I do understand my own spirituality and my priesthood in that kind of way. I mean, that doesn't mean I'll always, you know, be employed by the Church of England, as it were, you know, but my identity it is deep, you know, deep into who I am. And I guess all of my tattoos are an outworking expression of that. There is something, I think, quite also emotional about tattoos. I've been in tattoo parlours where someone's perhaps getting something done because they've had a mastectomy. So the reclaiming of that part of your body, you know, being in tattoo parlours where people are having something done because they've come out of a toxic relationship. And actually that tattoo, it might be a flower, whatever it is trying to tell a story that's deeply about your identity. And I think that's the bit, and that's the connection for me with the spirituality.
Gabby.
I think that's a really good point, that tattoos are always about identity. So it's either the identity we already have, I am this, hence I tattoo this, or it's an identity we want to go towards. I want to be, I don't know, strong, so I tattoo a beer on my forearm, whatever. But that identity and tattoos are very much intertwined. And hence, in a world where tattooing is maybe becoming more mainstream and less kind of frowned upon, identity and markers of identity will inevitably be tattooed a lot, even if it's like legalistically prohibited.
Terenitu.
I mean, we're quite passionate about our culture and our traditions and, of course, reclaiming those things through colonization and all of that kind of stuff. But Yeah, for us, our identity is what we've been left with. I mean, it's identifying us as what tribe we come from, what we do within that tribe, whether we're gardeners, whether we're weavers, whether we're carvers, whether we're sailors, whether we're all of these different things. It's a language without words. It also keeps us kind of humble. They can be read. So when you go on to a marae, you needed to know friend from foe, so they could read the tattoos, who was in the crowd coming onto your longhouse and stuff. And as you were greeted, they knew what conversation to keep as well, depending on what tribe they were in and things like that. So to us, it's a language.
Gabby, is there anything you wouldn't tattoo? I mean, do you get requests and you go, I don't feel really comfortable doing that?
Absolutely, a lot.
Oh, do you?
All the time, yes, of course. When I was younger, I would just not want to draw out anything that wasn't like exactly how I felt about the world, because I was young and I thought, you know, I knew exactly what was right and what was wrong. And with the years, I became maybe a little bit more humble. But there are still things that I won't draw, anything racist and anything that feels like self-harm. In creating tattoos for people, there's a huge responsibility. And I take pride in really taking that responsibility seriously.
Terenitu, is there anything that you wouldn't tattoo? Have you got limits?
I think the person's just got to be stable, you know, and because we have a lot of young men that come to us that aren't quite ready for what they want. And so we'll ask them to go see their aunties, their uncles, and we're not saying no, never. They'll go and they'll get advice and come back and see us. And it might take 2 years, it might take whatever years, whatever it takes.
What about Westerners coming into you?
Westerners, I guess, for me, I tattoo Westerners. So what I'm against is Westerners tattooing our patterns. You know, we can tell when it's not done properly, and it's got its own language. Well, I have seen men wearing things that they've said, you know, they've had babies and stuff like that, and they're wearing female patterns and stuff like that. So if you don't really know what the patterns are, you know, like typical bush law is that if you don't know what it is, you don't touch it. You know, leave it for the people that are...
And is there anxiety about cultural appropriation?
Definitely. I mean, we're probably, Māori culture are probably one of the leading indigenous peoples that protect their cultures and have taken people to court and things like that. You know, if it's done by a person, especially Māori or Māori heritage, that knows his culture, that has been taught properly, and you know, and his job is really my job to guide the person properly. And if anything goes wrong, that comes up back on me, not on anyone else. You know, so we have to be correct at what we do, kind of thing. And so we have a lot of responsibilities as well to guide that person. But, yeah, when you see other people wearing kind of patterns that you know they don't know what it is, you know they got it done by someone that just saw a picture and tattooed it on them, it's not so much embarrassing to us. It really says a lot about the person, though, and that they haven't thought about what they have put on their body, and they don't know. Like, I came across an American guy that had two tribes on him and have a history of not liking each other.
Brilliant.
So, you know, one sleeve and the other sleeve is, oh, where are you going? And he was like, oh, you know, I'm going down south. And I said, I'd cover that one down, you know, just wear that one, but don't I'll cover that one, kind of thing, you know. And it's just like, you've got to beware of, this is a language, it's a living culture, it's not passed away or anything like that, kind of thing. So you've got to be careful. And we have spiritual kind of beliefs on them as well.
I mean, we've talked very seriously about tattoos, and all three of you have talked very movingly about the sort of spiritual significance of tattoos. But there is another side of tattoos, which is people who might have a bit too much drink and want to have the name of their boyfriend tattooed on their bottom or something like that. Or going back, the idea that this is something to do with convicts or something to do with, you know, the disreputable. Now, that feels to me like it's changed or has quite substantially changed. Gabby?
I noticed it changed. Why did it change? That's a very good question. It is definitely part of just modernity and hence individualism, the individual expression of one's own identity became relevant, became important only in the last, I don't know, maybe 50 years, 70 years possibly.
Right.
And then the personal expression in tattoos, of course, goes along with that.
Terranito, I'm very interested in how you hear that, because there seems to be a slight difference. One is about individual expression. This is about my individuality and so forth. And that's yours right. is about your deep cultural roots.
Yeah. And, you know, in Western culture, tattooing has always been the individual, has always been kind of expressive of the individual. When we get tattooed, we belong to a people. Yeah. We belong to the land kind of thing. And it's all of us as one kind of thing. It's not a separate kind of thing. And so even to be in a tribe, you know, sometimes you don't agree, but there's always a space to argue the point. And, of course, we're a culture that's always evolved. And with all of the challenges that we've seen in the birth of our kind of cultures and stuff like that, all of the different things, the oceans that we've traversed, you know, the ocean to us connects us. It doesn't separate us. It's just another movement from the land onto the ocean kind of thing. So, you know, all of that means we're a very close-knit kind of family. We look after each other, but we look after others as well and welcome people to New Zealand. Because that's our culture, that's our traditions kind of thing. So,
Gabby, can I set you aside what we've just heard there? Because the way in which you described tattoos to me sounded much more individualistic.
Absolutely. I think everything happens within a cultural context. So there's no contradiction between his take on tattoos and my or the Western take on tattoos. And I think actually there is one place where these two meet within my own practice. And that is, first of all, yes, it's an individualist act and it's a modern act. But then people who come to me for my art on their skin are not busy with just having something beautiful on their body. And they're not even busy with just their own spiritual journey, although that is a really, really important part of almost any work I've ever drawn. But they look for that spirituality. They look for that connection, for that oneness, for that unity within their own roots. So these two things, they, in a way, they meet in my art. It's Hebrew letters, the tradition, it's connecting to our own roots, to the prayers of our fathers, to our ancestry, within an act that is inherently and inevitably individualistic and modern. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes complete sense to me. I'd like to know how Wendy puts herself on this spectrum.
Yeah, I suppose, what am I thinking about? I'm thinking that in some ways everyone thinks they're an individual, but you look around at Christian imagery or tattoos, and actually I don't think anyone's got a tattoo on their body, she says confidently, that is completely unique, because we're drawing on cultural symbols. So if you were to look at my arms in any depth, you would recognise symbolism that you would recognise, particularly if you've got a Christian heritage. So I don't think it's quite as clear cut as that. I think it's a fair critique, you know, that it is me wanting to express myself, but that's within a context of community. So if you go back to where we started, almost with the Razook pilgrimage tattoo, I wanted to get that for myself. But I wanted to get it because it connected me to a whole history and heritage of pilgrimage in a very special place. So, it's connecting to a story. I don't think they're entirely individualistic. I think they're part of the storytelling that we do, and we mostly do storytelling in the context of community.
I just love the idea that you have written on your body something of your spiritual history and that it records it. You know, even the stuff that might not be where you are now, it sort of records something of that journey. It's very powerful stuff. Thank you very much indeed for what was an absolutely terrific conversation between Wendy Dalrymple, Canon of Ripa Cathedral, Terranitu Natana, who's Maori living in New Zealand and who's been up at God knows how late to talk to us. Thank you very much, my friend. And Gabby Wolf, who's a tattoo artist and specialises in Hebrew tattoos. I honestly think I'm going to go out and get one. Oh, my word, my mind has been changed.
Beyond Belief was presented by Giles Fraser, and it was produced by Catherine Longworth. The reporter was Malak Hasune, and it was a BBC Audio North production for Radio 4. Next week, Giles visits Kensal Green Cemetery to delve into beliefs around graveyards. Elephant grass, what is it and why is it important? We meet a grower in On Your Farm. That's coming up in just a moment.
On BBC iPlayer.
You can see the finish line. It's not far away, no?
They're on a journey into the unknown.
Everyone wants to be first, but you only really want to be first on the last leg.
A race of more than 12,000 kilometres.
Try to be just a little bit more calm.
The further they go...
There is a lot of pressure on this leg.
The closer they'll get.
He wants more now.
It's going to give me positives as I make the way journey through life.
Race Across the World continues on Wednesday on BBC iPlayer.
Now on BBC Radio 4, time for On Your Farm, and Sarah Swadling is somewhere in North Cornwall.
Quite often I'd start an edition of On Your Farm talking about the view. But at the moment I can't do that because of the crop that is surrounding me. It's quite an extraordinary thing. It must be 6, 7, 8 feet tall. And at the moment, it looks quite a lot like garden canes. I'm with James Mutton, who grows this crop here in North Cornwall on his family farm, partway between Bodmin and Wadebridge. James, tell me about it.
Miscanthus, it's related to the bamboo family. It looks a little bit like bamboo, although it has a pith in the middle rather than being hollow. But it's a perennial grass, and it's a very fast-growing crop, commonly known as elephant grass. But there are different varieties. We're actually growing two different varieties on the farm, one which we've grown for many a year and a new one which we're trialling. And we actually grow it for sort of diversified products, such as equine bedding. But primarily, it is an energy crop. It was originally grown in this country for fuel, to burn in the power stations for fuel.
How do you grow it?
You initially plant a rhizome. Looks a bit like a daffodil bulb in a raw sort of way, a raw sort of form. But it's a rhizome. Once that rhizome is planted, it is a perennial grass, so it will reshoot every year. So you harvest, once you harvest in the spring, it will grow new shoots. And we can actually see new shoots here amongst the standing cane as we speak, partly because it's been so mild in the last week, 10 days. And that just shows how fast growing this crop is.
Oh yeah, if I look down, I can see that there are green shoots of this broad grass. It looks a bit like a massive... sort of couch grass or something like that, quite a broad green grass.
Yeah, no, it does. So the new shoots, they're currently about 6 inches tall, and once the cane's been cleared, they will grow, and within 3-4 months you will start from a shoot in millimeters high to an 8-9 foot tall crop within a few months, and it will continue growing to sort of the autumn. Up to the autumn, you'll have a mass of green leaf, and then it will senesce. It will die away during the winter months, and that's when you come sort of February, March time, you end up with sort of this beigey sort of colour cane. It loses its leaf during the winter months, and that leaf, we're looking here now and seeing the leaf on the floor, which forms a mulch, and that mulch then suppresses weeds. It maintains sort of phosphate, potash elements to the crop and to the soil. So it's more or less self-fertilising.
Behind us, there's a grassy strip and a big Cornish hedge bank that at the moment is all frothy and white with hawthorn in blossom.
This grass wildlife buffer, we include lots of wildflowers, herbs, legumes, etc. It'll add a little extra income because we can include that as part of our countryside stewardship or SFI scheme.
So the sustainable farming incentive.
Exactly that. But it benefits the crop, and it provides a further habitat for the wildlife that's in the hedgerow. It extends that. It ticks a lot of boxes from the sort of sustainability and wildlife perspective.
So what made you start growing Miscanthus in the first place?
We first planted Miscanthus in 2002. I left college in 2001. Miscanthus was being talked about in sort of the the late 90s and early noughties.
It was going to be the next big thing, wasn't it?
It was. Did it materialise? Probably not to the extent that it was talked about. But we were looking at diversified projects and other cropping. And I knew a company in Somerset, and we decided to grow a small amount. So in 2002, we grew our first, it was a small acreage, about 15 acres. And we grew that actually on a rhizome contract. So those rhizomes were actually lifted 3 years later.
So is that a bit like growing daffodil bulbs for production?
Exactly that. So it's about multiplying area. We did that, and it was, you know, it was a good contract for 3 years. That company that was involved back then is no longer. To be honest, without them, Miscanthus probably wouldn't be where it is today. But that said, we were then left with a certain area of Miscanthus which didn't really have a market for. So we started looking at alternatives, and animal bedding was one of them. So we did a few trials. This is like 2007, 2008. We applied to the Rural Development Programme in England for some funding.
And so that was EU money, wasn't it, back in the day?
It was EU money. We had the go-ahead, we had a 40% funding to put a production plant in, put a building in, some processing equipment, and basically set up our own animal bedding business. And from 2009, we sort of developed the business to where we are today.
Going back to 2002, what was the farm business then?
We were a very traditional farm. I used to call it beef, sheep and arable traditional farm, and we were. We did move the farm into organic in 2006, but still a beef, sheep and arable. I was looking to do something different. We were lucky enough to have a relatively large farm for North Cornwall. But even back then, I said to myself, I want to keep the core farming in amongst the mix of the business, and very much we are still doing that.
2002, that was a difficult time for livestock farming. We'd just come out of the big foot and mouth outbreak in 2001. It wasn't long after the BSE crisis that hit beef farming. Yep. So was that part of the impetus to make you think, I need to be doing something extra on the farm?
Yeah, I think it was. I think we wanted to sort of spread our mixed farming system.
A bit more mixed.
I know some farms probably over the years have gone the other way. Some farms have gone very much more specialised. But we've sort of kept in the mix. And I think we've benefited as a business, but I think the farm has benefited. I think there's a lot to be said for mixed farming in regards to sort of soil health, animal health and general, you know, wildlife habitats, etc., etc.
Where we've come to now, this part of the field, it's a real contrast to where we began, because stretching out in front of me are rows of little green shoots that are about 6-8 inches tall.
This half of the field was only planted last year. Being a young crop, there wasn't enough cane, Miscanthus cane, to harvest. So what we did, we topped it about a month ago. Needs a bit of warmth. You can see the leaves are a little bit on the yellow side. It just needs some warmth to warm up, and then get the soil temperature up, and they'll bolt. And then come late summer, early autumn, this will be up to sort of 8-9 foot. And then this will be harvested properly next year in its second year.
Where does Miscanthus originate from in the world?
It originates from Southeast Asia. It's, you know, in today's modern world where sustainability is, you know, is key. It doesn't take any fertilisers, very little chemicals. We did put some glyphosate on here, but it just needs some weed control during the first 2 years.
And how long would a field of Miscanthus last, if you like, with the same plants?
So next door to us is our original field that was planted in 2002. It was lifted in 2005, so you could argue it was replanted in 2005. So it's going strong. It's 21 years old. I know there's crops out of Cornwall, still in the southwest, which are over 30 years old. There will be a time the crop comes to its end of its life. But with crops over, you know, between 20 and 30 years, it's got to be a good option for farmers.
How does Miscanthus take to the Cornish warm, wet climate then?
Miscanthus likes moisture. That said, it will more or less grow anywhere. I mean, we're on reasonable land in North Cornwall, but it will grow on on what we call marginal land. There's a bit of work being done on promoting miscanthus. You know, miscanthus, we're not trying to compete for food, we're not trying to compete where areas where food production is certainly at its prime.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. There's a lot of discussion at the moment about land use and what we should be using land for, and the competing demands upon land for energy, for conservation, for food production. How does it sit with you, having come from a many generations livestock farm, to be producing a crop which isn't food?
I got mixed views on it, and I got different hats as well when I discuss it, because you're right, I come from a family farm, and we have very much always been sort of that mixed livestock and arable farming. We still are. My argument is that we're growing what's in demand. Surely it's better to be producing it in this country than reliance on other countries, import, etc., etc.
So what proportion of the farm is miscanthus then?
Roughly, the farm is 800 acres and 200 acres of miscanthus. So a quarter of the farm is in miscanthus. I would say another half of the farm is also producing crops for the equine industry, and that's mainly haylage and hay. And the remaining quarter is for the sort of the remaining beef and lamb, the beef and sheep.
Is it a simple question of follow the money that has led to that balance of enterprises?
Yes and no. It's also workload. It's also how each enterprise benefits each other. So we're trying to maintain our beef numbers, partly because we're producing a lot of muck, a lot of dung, which can go back on the fields. Sort of everything is a full cycle. Same with the sheep. The sheep benefit through grazing, and the corn crops sort of fit in well with the rotation.
How do you harvest miscanthus, James?
So miscanthus is harvested with a traditional forager.
Bit like the machine that you would use for harvesting maize.
Exactly that. Harvested similar to maize, but it's dropped in a swath. So it looks similar to when straw comes out the back of the combine. It'll be in swaths in the field, and depending on moistures, it'll be left down for anything from 2 days up to sort of 2 or 3 weeks. The miscanthus cane is then baled into a large square bale. So that moisture needs to be under 15% when it's put into a large bale. If it's not, like straw or hay or anything, it would start to heat up. The beauty about what we do is the elements do the work. So once the crop is cut and it's in that swath, the sun and the wind, that will naturally take the moisture out. And miscanthus, it's not like a normal wheat or barley straw. It will dry quicker, and if it has a bit of rain on it, it will dry again. It's a relatively easy crop to harvest.
It is quite a grey, moist, drizzly kind of day, and that's stopped harvesting though.
It has. That said, in the last few minutes the wind sort of picked up. I can see some blue sky. The forager might be cutting again this afternoon. So we were cutting yesterday. Yesterday was a glorious day. This morning we had some of our traditional Cornish mizzle, so it has stopped play for a minute. So yeah, we'll see where the weather takes us over the next sort of 24-48 hours. So we're back in the yard now. We're looking at the main bale sheds. So that is where all the raw material, all the miscanthus, comes in from the fields. It's all selected in different batches, different crops. As we can hear behind us, those bales are being moved from the bale sheds to the processing sheds. There's about those three sheds hold the best part of 3,000 bales there. Most of that has been Cornwall and Devon grown. But we do buy some miscanthus from other growers. We've got growers that grow for us up in Somerset, and we do buy miscanthus from growers further afield. Partly help spread the risk, but also to increase our raw material supply.
Let's just look into the processing shed then. It is quite noisy in here. To our right then, there's a straw chopper machine. It's got a great big plastic tub on the top of it which rotates and kind of minces a bale of miscanthus straw in it as it rotates?
Yep. The cane in the bale is anywhere from sort of 6 inches to 18 inches long, and the tub grinder is taking it down to sort of 3 to 4 inches long. Then behind the tub grinder, we've got a little red machine, which is a hammer mill. That hammer mill then takes that 3-4 inches right down to its desired length. We use different size screens depending on what material they're using, what customer we're looking to supply. Today we've got a 20mm screen in there, so we'll end up with not quite 20mm, about a 25mm Lenkins canvas. And that will then go through the dust extraction and be packaged. It's three processes really. You've got your tub grinder, your hammer mill and your dust extraction.
James Mutton is just opening the door into another slightly quieter shed, which is the other side of the wall to the very noisy machines that we just heard.
So there's four different production lines. There's three running today. Behind us we've got the bedding, which is the miscanthus. So miscanthus is being packed into 19-20 kilogram bales. That's on a very fully automated system. We can watch the robot there stacking the pallets, so that's controlled by one man. At the other end of the shed we've got the haylage, the big rectangular bales being split and teased apart. That is being packed into 20 kilogram bales here. That's very much more of a manual system, so you've literally got a man on the end of a chute putting a bag on and manual stacking. Brian is there, he's running the pellet system. That is actually our byproduct, so that is the dust that we extract from the bedding is being separated and then going straight into a bedding pellet. So we are using 100% of all the miscanthus that is harvested from the field is being used in one product or another. To be honest, the demand for our pellets is greater than what we can produce at the moment. Generally, pellets as a bedding product, you do sprinkle water on it, the pellets then will expand slightly and then they are then readily available to absorb the moisture. So we do make a briquette or a heat log out of miscanthus. We also make it out of wood waste as well. So we're making two different products.
So you are still using miscanthus as the energy crop?
Yes, yes we are. We also run two biomass boilers on the farm and they are also using miscanthus as the fuel source to produce heat for the offices, for the farmhouse. But also, in turn, we do use that heat for drying a certain amount of the crop as well.
Just coming into the office now, and Jo Jones is working away at her desk. Are you fielding the calls from people who want to buy the products and making sure it all goes out to time and to the right place?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I mean, with James's help, we work together and sort out logistics and make sure the product gets sent out. Yep.
How far afield are you sending products?
I think we go as far up as North Wales and across from there at the moment. We're hoping, I think, to go a little bit further afield, but that's product allowing, really.
James, how many people are you employing here?
We employ 12 full-time currently. Well, those 12 people are a mix between office, lorry, production team and the farm team. On top of that, we have Tim and Lucy on sales and marketing who live away from Cornwall but very much part of the team.
The business has obviously become a lot more complex as it's grown. So how has it been for you to just start delegating and start bringing in people who have, you know, completely different skill sets to complement what you do?
Very much a learning curve. and everything's, we're always learning, but that's what I enjoy about it. 10 years ago, I would never have believed that we would ever have such a large team. But everyone has their important part to play in the business. We've got a great team here.
How valuable is it to have a small business like this in quite a rural community in Cornwall, which, you know, has some challenges in providing year-round high-quality jobs?
I would say it's quite unusual, really, and I feel very privileged to be part of this team, actually. It's lovely to be part of a business that can, you know, encourage employment. As you say, it's a hard environment, especially North Cornwall. We don't have the tourism so much as a backup income as perhaps the South Coast has. So, yeah, it's nice to be part of it.
We're overlooking a scene of peace and contentment.
So this is the lambing shed. We don't have the sheep numbers we used to. We used to lamb 800-900. We're lambing 250 this year. We've got a few in front of us here in the shed. This is triplets and some singles. This enables us to adopt any triplet lambs onto singles. All the doubles are lambing outside, so hence there's only a select few indoors. But it also gives us a facility. If the weather does suddenly change, we can bring in ewes and lambs from the field. I'm a livestock farmer by heart, and I enjoy the livestock. They can be a pain at certain times of the year because there's always something to do with sheep. They have a big workload, but lambing time, I do enjoy it.
Has the business, though, taken you away from farming, and could it potentially take you further away from farming in the future?
Yeah, without a doubt it could. I mean, for example, 10 years ago, when Burley Bed, or the whole Miscanthus and Burley Bed part of the business was fairly new, that was probably only 10% of the business, and 90% of the business was the core farming, be it the beef, sheep and arable. Now, 10 years later, or more than 10 years later, it's very much role reversal. From a business point of view, 90% of it is Miscanthus plus other products, and 10% of it is farm. So it's very much role reversal. So my role has changed, and the business has very much changed, and it will continue to change.
If you were looking at this from pure business, from pure financial head leading the way, then you might not be still lambing sheep. You might not still be carving cows.
No, you're right. From somebody looking from the outside, looking in, would probably say, why am I still doing the sheep and the beef? But there are benefits of having the beef and the sheep. I mentioned earlier that everything is so interlinked. Our breeding is at a level which they're very extensive. They can look after themselves. And it's taken a number of years to get to that stage. So I wouldn't want to all of a sudden get rid of the beef and sheep. And then if you wanted to develop in the future, you'd have to start from scratch. My wife and I, we've got two young children. Who knows what their interest is going to be in 10, 15 years' time. So I think that's an important reason to keep the core farming. They might well want to be involved, want to be interested. And I think while the core farming still very much has benefits to the business as a whole, let's keep it there.
And keeps life interesting.
It certainly keeps life interesting, certainly does.
In this week's On Your Farm, James Mutton was speaking to Sarah Swantling, who produced and presented the programme. On Your Farm is a BBC Audio Bristol production. As Sir David Attenborough turns 100, our programme Sunday asks what his lifelong work revealing the natural world has meant, not just scientifically, but spiritually. Sunday is at 7:10. Now, though, time for a weather update. Let's say good morning to Simon King.
Neil, thank you. Good morning, everybody. We have got a split in the weather at the moment across the UK, across Scotland, Northern Ireland, the far north of England. It's been a pretty cold night. We've had a touch of frost in places. Temperatures, in fact, in Shap in Cumbria, still currently about -4°C. Further south, though, across England and Wales, a bit more cloud around and some milder air in place, and temperatures currently about 9 or 10°C. So let's start off in southwest and southeast England, eastern England, the Midlands and Wales, where it's mostly cloudy. We've got a few showers just across the far southeast of England this morning. As we go through the morning, the cloud will tend to break up, so there will be some sunny spells developing. Perhaps still the odd shower in the far southeast of England, and a bit more of a breeze as well across southern England. Coming in from the east, northeast, it's certainly going to make it feel chillier than yesterday. So while yesterday temperatures got to 23 degrees in East Sussex, today we'll see temperatures for many across these southern areas about 11 to 17 Celsius. Temperatures across Wales, Midlands, eastern England, that'll also be about 11 to 14 degrees. For northwest and northeast England, some clear skies and a chilly start, as I mentioned. There will be some sunshine, though, and the cloud will tend to thicken up and build into the afternoon. There'll still be some sunny spells, though, with temperatures 11 to 13 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, there's a chilly start with clear skies, lots of sunshine initially, but we will see cloud increasing here, highs of 12 to 14 degrees. And for Scotland, again, a cold start. Temperatures generally about 1 to 3 Celsius, but there is a frost out there in more rural areas. Lots of sunshine before the cloud increases, really. Then we'll see rain spreading into northern and northwestern areas. And that will spread up into the northeast as well. That rain particularly heavy in the Northern Isles, I think, during this afternoon. And we'll see maximum temperatures today getting to about 9 to 12 Celsius.
All right, many thanks, Armin King. Later this week, Radio 4 begins a new investigation into the criminal underworld.
2 years ago, we tracked down the head of one of the largest cross-channel people smuggling gangs. Now we want to unmask the man believed to control an entire network.
He threw the whole family in the water.
So a whole family died?
They did.
I'm Sue Mitchell, investigating with my friend Rob Laurie.
If I get the name, I know I can find him.
Our hunt takes us from the UK, across Europe, into the Middle East.
He's working between Libya and France.
And it will be dangerous.
Pop, 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 pop.
Very violent.
To Catch a King starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Wednesday morning at 9:30.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday the 10th of May. Good morning, this is Alan Smith. Sir Keir Starmer has said he wants to be Prime Minister for a decade as he prepares to mount a fight back against growing calls for a change in Number 10. The cruise ship at the centre of a fatal outbreak of hantavirus has arrived in Tenerife, where those on board will be evacuated. Religious and business leaders have signed an open letter in support of the UK's Jewish community. Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he will lead Labour into the next general election, despite growing calls for him to step aside after the party's drubbing in polls across England, Scotland and Wales. He's told the Observer newspaper that last week's results were very tough, but that his government was a 10-year project of renewal. The Prime Minister will use a speech tomorrow to try to win back support, but he could also face a challenge to his leadership. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The Prime Minister wants to get on the front foot after last Thursday's dismal electoral performance. He'll draw bold dividing lines with Reform UK by saying he won't hold back from seeking closer ties to Brussels, and that he expects to launch a scheme to allow young EU citizens to work temporarily in the UK and vice versa next year. He'll have to convince an increasingly sceptical Labour Party that he has the ideas and ability to improve its historically low poll ratings. Tomorrow is also the deadline set by the former minister Catherine West for leadership challenges to Sir Keir to step up, otherwise she'll launch her own bid. Some MPs on the party's centre-left have tried, so far unsuccessfully, to persuade her to ditch her plan because they would rather Sir Keir occupied Number 10 temporarily until the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham can return to Westminster at a by-election. But Sir Keir has no intention of departing either abruptly or via an orderly transition. He told the Observer newspaper he intends to lead his party into the next election and would be willing to serve a second term as Prime Minister.
The cruise ship hit by a deadly outbreak of hantavirus has arrived at the Spanish island of Tenerife, where those on board will be allowed to disembark. The 22 British passengers and staff will be tested and taken back to the UK. They'll isolate at the same hospital on Merseyside used as a quarantine site at the start of the COVID pandemic. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Tenerife.
The Hondius won't be allowed to come to shore here in Tenerife. The cruise ship will anchor out at sea instead so that people can then be ferried to land in small groups, then taken onto charter flights home from the airport. This is a complex operation involving more than 24 countries. It'll be managed by medics and officials in protective masks. The head of the World Health Organization, who's overseeing things here, has told Spaniards he understands their concerns, stressing that the risk to the general population was low. The hantavirus is carried by rodents and not normally transmitted between people, but 3 died on the Hondius and several people have been infected. At the isolation unit of a local hospital, an emergency care bed has been made ready should anyone else fall seriously ill. But for now, no one showing any symptoms.
Officials in Lebanon say 39 people were killed yesterday in a series of strikes by the Israeli military. Hezbollah said it responded by launching rockets and drones into northern Israel. Israeli forces and Hezbollah have continued to trade fire since President Trump announced a ceasefire deal between the governments of Israel and Lebanon last month. Our Middle East correspondent Wira Davis reports from Jerusalem.
This is a ceasefire in name only. Almost every day since it began in mid-April, Israel has attacked what it says are Hezbollah positions that, according to the IDF, pose an imminent threat to its soldiers and civilians. In the latest strikes, Israel says it hit more than 85 targets, mainly in southern Lebanon, but also in the eastern Bekaa Valley. But many civilians, including very young children, have been killed in the Israeli attacks, including families who had already been displaced by the war. In the southern town of Saksiye, at least 7 people were killed, said the Lebanese health ministry.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said he thinks the conflict with Ukraine is coming to an end. He made the comment as he spoke to reporters in the Kremlin after Russia held its most scaled-back Victory Day parade in years. But Mr. Putin said he would only meet his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, once a lasting peace deal was agreed. Leaders of business organisations and religious groups have signed a letter telling the British Jewish community that they will do everything they can to protect it from anti-Semitism. Their commitment is a response to a number of attacks on British Jews and Jewish sites in recent weeks. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
Anti-Semitism is not a problem for Jewish people to have to respond to, says the letter. This is a problem for all of us to fix. The letter has been signed by religious leaders from the Muslim, Christian, Sikh and Hindu communities, by the Confederation of British Industry, the Football Association, Universities UK, ITV, The Guardian, the Local Government Association and others. They say that as leaders of British organisations, they want to make clear they will do everything they can to protect Jewish communities from the extremists who threaten them. The Chief Rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, said it was heartening to see so many stand against anti-Jewish hatred. Later today, a rally against anti-Semitism will be held in central London, with thousands expected to attend.
The Netflix drama Adolescence leads the way at tonight's television BAFTAs with 6 nominations. It's also up for the Memorable Moment Award, along with the Celebrity Traitors, which is chosen by a public vote. Our entertainment correspondent Lisa Mazimbo looks ahead to the ceremony.
I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder.
Adolescence's nominations include Best Actor for Stephen Graham.
I want you to tell me the truth.
Best Supporting Actor for teenager Owen Cooper.
I just want to go home. I've not done anything.
Erin Doherty is up for Best Supporting Actress and also has a Best Actress nomination for the historical drama 1,000 Blows. Amy Lou Wood also has double acting nominations for her roles in the comedy dramas Film Club and The White Lotus. While in the Best Actress in a Comedy category, 3 of the nominations are from Amandaland: Jennifer Saunders, Philippa Dunn and Lucy Punch. The Celebrity Traitors is nominated in Best Reality and in Best Entertainment Performance for its host Claudia Winkleman. And BAFTA's highest honour, the Fellowship, will go to Dame Mary Berry.
That's the BBC News. Now let's take a look at the Sunday papers, and almost all focus on the Prime Minister's future. The Sunday Telegraph calls the Labour MP Catherine West's threat to launch a leadership challenge a stalking horse plot to oust Starmer. One serving minister tells the paper she would probably gain the backing of the 81 MPs needed to prompt a contest. If Starmer had a plot, he's lost it, is the Mail on Sunday's headline. The Sunday Mirror says Sir Keir is planning to slash energy bills in a bid to turn around his party's fortunes. The Sun on Sunday calls the Prime Minister's decision to bring Gordon Brown and Harriet Harman back into government a desperate bid to save his skin. The Sunday Times says the move failed to quell a growing backbench revolt. The paper's front page cartoon shows a stuffed dodo saying, "If Gordon Brown can make a comeback, there's hope for us all." "Gord, help us all," declares the Daily Star Sunday on its front page. Sir Keir has used an interview with The Observer to vow that he will stay on and fight the next general election. In it, he says he has a strong belief that there aren't many people who actually want Zach Polanski or Nigel Farage as their prime minister. But Mr Farage tells the Sunday Express the economic and social consequences for the country don't bear thinking about if Sir Keir stays on until 2029. The Observer says Mr Farage could face a recall petition and by-election over a £5 million donation he received from a cryptocurrency tycoon before he became an MP. It says he may face investigations by the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner and the Electoral Commission. The paper says it understands the elections regulator will decide whether to start its probe as early as this week. Reform UK says it complied with all the relevant rules, and Mr Farage has told the Mail the donation was legal and used to fund his security. The editorial sections have differing views about whether Sir Keir Starmer should stay on as Prime Minister. The Telegraph says he should enact a final U-turn and resign. The Mail says whoever seeks to succeed Sir Keir will first need to drag him out of number 10. But the Mirror says toppling the PM now would cause chaos and instead argues for him to change his approach. The Observer also cautions against a leadership contest. It says Sir Keir is no storyteller and could make "We will fight them on the beaches" sound like a mortgage application. But it argues attempting to change prime ministers now would only signal national instability. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
Alan Smith, many thanks. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 7:10, time for Sunday with Emily Buchanan.
Welcome to Sunday. In the wake of attacks on Jews in the UK, diverse religious leaders publish a letter in support of the Jewish community. We ask a rabbi and a leading Muslim why solidarity is more important than ever. With a new exhibition exploring 125 years of Black British music, the curator takes us back to its early religious roots.
The very publication used to oppress created the vocal quality for all popular musics, which is the gospel voice. Like, oh, you can sing. Oh, yes, you can sing.
And as David Attenborough celebrates his 100th birthday, do you remember this infamous encounter?
I felt a hand come out on my head, and it was an adult female, and she twisted my head so she could look straight at my eyes and looked inside my mouth and put a finger in my mouth.
We talked to a bishop about whether those groundbreaking and magical wildlife documentaries have given us a spiritual understanding of nature. Do send your comments to sunday@bbc.co.uk. The Dutch cruise ship that was the scene of the deadly outbreak of the rare hantavirus has arrived just offshore in Tenerife. Passengers will have to continue to isolate after the WHO confirmed that 6 cases worldwide have died. Britons on the ship will be repatriated to isolate at Arrow Park Hospital in Merseyside, which was a UK COVID quarantine site. It's all raised again the issue of how to manage disease at sea and the human impact on passengers and crew trapped on board. Stella Maris is the largest Catholic charity dealing with seafarers. The Reverend Nick O'Neill is its senior area port chaplain for the south of England and Wales. And I asked him what happens when the chaplains get a call to assist in an emergency.
If we are contacted, then obviously the first thing is not to try and interfere with any of the medical team that might be on board already. We're not experts, obviously, in controlling outbreaks. So, but what we would do is we would offer any support that we can practically offer. And it might be also that we need to make sure that we're not spreading any misinformation. So depending on the severity, we can't go on board. So we would be maybe linking up with them digitally. So it might be that we do WhatsApp or Messenger, or the company set up some way for us to speak to them on a digital platform. And really, we could then offer one-to-one via WhatsApp or those digital platforms.
So can you sort of talk us through what would be going on then? The outbreak happens, you've got crew, you've got passengers, some of them sick, huge amounts of anxiety amongst probably both the crews and the passengers. How does the chaplaincy work at that point?
We would probably offer support to any passengers, but our charity is primarily focused and honed in on the crew. So the seafarers that are working, especially for cruise ships, for example, the company would be really looking after them. But I think what the difficulty they have is obviously they are trying to separate everybody from contaminating each other or spreading whatever the disease is. So they will then basically have a bit like a lockdown on the ship for a period of time. We are only there really digitally, I suppose, to suppose primarily let the seafarers know someone ashore understands the situation they're in and how that might be making them feel. And then we're there to listen and offer what support they might ask us for in the way we can do it.
So just to be clear then, a seafaring chaplain isn't on the ship all the time, isn't going around the world on these cruises?
No. The only time we would say have chaplains on board sailing, this is Stella Maris, at Christmas and Easter, P&O cruise ships and AIDA cruises have asked us to put priests on board those ships for those two liturgical times of the year. And a priest will go on board and sail for 10 days to 2 weeks and perform the sacraments, celebrate mass for the crew and the passengers. But chaplains don't sail routinely on ships.
When do you feel in your role that you've had the most impact?
I have a personal kind of passion for supporting inshore fishermen. So these would be local inshore fishermen, and especially as it's a declining industry and there's a lot less fishermen now in the UK. And in this role, I get to visit a lot of fishermen and a lot of fishing communities. And I just like the fact that they are, again, very sort of tough men in a tough industry doing very hard work. They find it hard sometimes to believe there are people that want to be there to care for them.
Do you think generally life at sea is getting harder?
Everything's probably determined by the companies and money. I mean, it's business, so I understand that. So now ships are at sea a lot more. So they spend less time in the ports and in the harbours because they want the turnaround to be as quick as possible. So turnaround times are very tight. Sometimes they won't get shore leave. And it's one of the other issues we're sort of normally quite concerned about is if that's happening continuously, when do they get shore leave? If they're always turnarounds are hours.
And also, of course, you've got these ships stuck in the Strait of Hormuz. There must be huge demand for the chaplains at the moment there.
Those ships are normally on cycles and routes, so they probably visit ports at different times through the year. So, you know, we can offer support via WhatsApp, via Messenger, and I say it's quite a volatile. We had it recently as well with the Ukraine war, and then in the Middle East there were ships that were being sort of attacked and drones and people were having to take sort of diversions and spend 3 or 4 or 5 extra days at sea to get to their destination. And that just adds pressure and the stress to those seafarers.
The Reverend Nick O'Neill from the charity Stella Maris.
I've been completely overwhelmed by birthday greetings from preschool groups to care home residents and countless individuals and families of all ages. I simply can't reply to each of you all separately, but I would like to thank you all most sincerely for your kind messages.
Sir David Attenborough, deeply touched by the deluge of tributes on his 100th birthday. His programmes have transformed both our understanding of the natural world and the threats it faces.
In some parts of the ocean, it's estimated that there are now over 1 million pieces of plastic for every square mile. And we're only beginning to discover just how seriously that affects marine life. Dolphins are at the top of this food chain, and it's now thought that pollutants may be building up in their tissues to such a degree that a mother's contaminated milk could kill her calf.
Well, that was a clip from the hugely influential Blue Planet series in 2017. And while the great man describes himself as an agnostic, has he also unintentionally shaped a spiritual as well as scientific understanding of the world around us? Well, I'm joined by the Bishop of Norwich, the Right Reverend Graham Usher. Now, Bishop, you're the lead bishop in the Church of England on the environment. Do you think Sir David Attenborough has given us this spiritual understanding of the natural world?
Oh, absolutely, undoubtedly. He's given us a sense through his programmes of a awe and wonder at nature. He's awakened consciousness. In a sense, as we notice in the Gospels, how Jesus pays attention and pays attention to the birds of the air and the lilies of the field. These programs made by Sir David Attenborough, but also the great team of people around him, the sound engineers, the camera people, the production team, have enabled us to experience aspects of the natural world that we would never see on our own.
And what is the spiritual aspect then? Is it the sense of interconnectedness? Is it his absolute fascination for telling stories, the enabling us to identify with the natural world?
Well, I think it's a number of different things. I think the programmes very often lead us to both a sense of prayerful thankfulness for that which has illuminated our minds and our hearts and in the sights we've seen before us, but also, quite rightly, this sense of interconnectedness, that we are part of creation, not apart from it, and valuing the intrinsic value of nature, noticing too the impact that us humans have played and are playing and will continue to play on the natural environment around us. And I hope that then spurs people on to both individual action, to take the little steps each of us can make to protect the environment, to care for nature, to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, but also to lobby for global political action to care for this single island planet home of ours.
So do you see his programmes then, although he calls himself an agnostic, having a moral and even a theological impact?
Oh, absolutely, because you can look at it through that lens. And I've spoken to people indeed of other faith communities, because we work very closely together on environmental programs, but within our faith communities. But there is certainly a call to action for moral responsibility, that we're the first generation to truly see the impact of nature loss and the climate crisis we're in. And yet we're also the last generation who can make a difference. So I think there is this ethical obligation around stewardship that comes to the fore through Sir David Attenborough's programs, leading us to make choices about how we live and how we want future generations to experience this incredible planet that we inhabit. Are we happy, for example, one of the questions that he seems to keep asking, are we happy that our grandchildren and our grandchildren will not experience some aspect of the natural world that we currently do because it is so endangered?
And his influence perhaps on the church itself?
Oh, yes. And I see that certainly in the Church of England's environment programme, on the number of churches that are engaging with Eco Church, looking at how their church communities can be more sustainable, how churchyards can be places for nature, places of the living, not just the dead, right, and how we can truly celebrate the world around us.
Thank you very much. The Right Reverend Graham Usher. Now, vicars can be found in unexpected places. In fact, there are about 2,000 clergy known as self-supporting ministers who work in other roles. Some of them got in touch with us after we heard from the Reverend Andrea Mitchell, who's a priest based in Maidstone and also a full-time hairdresser.
People in the chair, we have journeyed together through all of the highs and lows of their lives and indeed mine. So it's easier to have deeper conversations.
One of the things it does is it takes me away from some of the tension of ministry, but it also keeps me very grounded as well. And one of the things that I really like about being able to do both roles is that the kickboxing and the taekwondo allow me to interact with people who wouldn't normally come to church.
I'll have conversations with students. I might be sat there teaching them a mechanics module, and then it's that end of the session. They're just walking out and one will stay back. And I'll think they're going to ask me an engineering question, and they ask me a question about religion.
That was the Reverend Dr. Alex Borman, head of the School of Engineering and Physical Sciences at the University of Lincoln. And before him, the Reverend Rich Wooten, who teaches kickboxing and taekwondo. Well, Sean Hicks also contacted us. 2.5 years ago, he suffered a major heart attack, followed by multiple cardiac arrests while he was in the back of an ambulance. He noticed the paramedic who was resuscitating him was wearing a dog collar under his uniform. That was Greater Manchester Duty Officer for the North West Ambulance Service, Father Matt Sanderson. He joins us now with his former patient, Sean, and this is something of a radio reunion for you both. But first of all, Sean, just tell us briefly what happened in that ambulance.
Yeah, I think you've covered it all. I had three cardiac arrests in the back of the ambulance on the way to the hospital. It was a three-quarters of an hour drive, and Matt brought me round each time. In between him resuscitating me, filling me with morphine and trying not to let me sleep, I noticed he was wearing a dog collar. And I retold the story over the coming days while I was in hospital, but nobody believed that I had actually been saved by a vicar.
What, they just thought you'd been imaginating or hallucinating?
Yeah, a mixture of the drugs and a near-death experience, I think people put it down to.
Gosh, and then what happened to Father Matt? What do you remember of that day?
I think it was at the end of a night shift, and I got called to Sean. And the couple of paramedics already there that were working with Sean had got him nicely packaged on the ambulance. And then Sean kept, well, basically dying on the way to the hospital. Talk about fighting for somebody's life, Sean. We worked hard for you. Whoever says there's not miracles that happen in this world, you're a living example that there is. And then I think later on you got repatriated to Oldham, which is when one of the nurses came over to me and said, look, we've got this guy in resource. Can you come and have a look at him? Because everyone's telling him he's crazy, that he's been resuscitated by this paramedic vicar. They've all been told and telling him that he's hypoxic and this, that and the other. So I came in and we got a lovely photograph in the resource department when you come back to Oldham.
That must have been an amazing moment, Sean.
It was amazing. Not the most flattering photograph of me ever, but needs must.
So you realised you hadn't been hallucinating after all?
No, I was vindicated.
I mean, I just wondered if you had anything you wanted to say to each other. I mean, that is an incredible moment, isn't it? That you did really nearly die in that ambulance, and here's the man who saved your life.
You don't need to say anything, Sean. You didn't nearly die. You actually did die. It's great to hear that 2.5 years on, that you are living hopefully a full and wonderful life.
I am. I mean, I'm absolutely 100% recovered. And, you know, on behalf of myself and my family, we'd like to thank you very much, Matt.
And Sean, I wondered, has there been any religious impact, given that your life was saved by a vicar? Impact on you, that is? I
mean, not in a direct way, but, you know, the whole thing was miraculous. And I've kind of taken that to heart personally.
And Father Matt, I mean, it's an extraordinary role you've had, isn't it? You're both sort of saving souls and literally saving lives.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute privilege doing what I do. I mean, when I first started my vocation within ministry, I was supposed to go full time. So if I had gone full time, I wouldn't have been there in the back of that ambulance with Sean. So it's just fascinating that God puts you in the right place at the right time.
And do you find yourself praying? I mean, at the moments when you were trying to save Sean's life, were you very conscious of being a vicar and having, in a sense, perhaps even extra responsibilities?
Absolutely. I mean, I think your role as a priest it's a whole life ministry. And your whole day is basically enveloped in prayer, be that the difficult conversations that you've got to have at work or the patients that you go out and see. I mean, in Sean's case, it was a positive outcome, but obviously we go to a lot of situations where it isn't quite as bright. And I think, you know, prayer is the thing that keeps you going, that hope that keeps you going.
And just a final word from you, Sean. Do you find yourself praying as well?
Not praying directly, no, but I have kind of looked at the whole situation and it's made me look at life and the world in a different light.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Sean Hicks and Father Matt Sanderson. Have you encountered a vicar in an unexpected setting? Just let us know on Sunday at bbc.co.uk. A police raid at a religious community in Cheshire has drawn attention to a little-known group calling itself the Ahmadi Religion of Peace and Light. There have been a dozen arrests so far by officers investigating allegations of serious sexual offences, modern slavery and forced marriage. The police are clear that they're investigating individuals, not beliefs. However, what exactly does this group believe and how do they differ from mainstream Muslims? Well, to shed some light is Dr. Sarah Harvey, Senior Research Officer at Inform, an independent charity based at King's College London, specialising in new religious movements. Good morning, Sarah. Can you first just explain what the Ahmadi Religion of Peace and Light is and how do they distinguish themselves from mainstream Islam?
Yes, good morning. So they have their roots in 12th Shia Islam, so that's already a minority movement, considering that Sunni Islam is the larger branch. But they're very unique and distinctive within that. They are very much focused on the centrality of their current leader, Abdullah Hashem. So they believe that he is the current Mahdi for the times that we're living in. And they have a view of history as distinguished into seven different covenants with God. And the Islamic religion, the covenant between God and Muhammad, was part of the sixth covenant, and we're currently in the seventh covenant. So that means that they have beliefs and practices which are different from mainstream Islam, if we can say that there is such a thing as that.
And it's completely modern. This is a completely sort of new movement, is it?
Yes, that's right. So it has its origins in 1990s Iraq with a man called Ahmad al-Hassan, who started teaching that he had met the 12th Mahdi of Shia Islam. And then in 2015, he is said to have appointed Abdullah Hashem, the current leader, as what's what they call within the movement the Qayyim or the Riser of the family of Muhammad.
Who is this Abdullah Hashem? How did he get that role?
Yes, so he is an Egyptian-American man. He's in his early 40s. He grew up in America and was a documentary filmmaker with an interest in religion. So his documentaries were about religion. And then he founded the movement, or this iteration of the movement, if you like, drawing on Ahmad al-Hassan's teachings in 2015 when he was based in Egypt. And the movement has moved around a little bit since then. So it moved into Europe. It was first in Germany and then in Sweden. And then it has had its headquarters in the UK since around 2021 or 22. And that's when it established its community in Cheshire.
And can we just draw a distinction between this Ahmadi religion of peace and light and the Ahmadiyya Muslim community?
Yes, that's correct. There is no connection whatsoever. They're completely separate movements. You know, there's similarity in the name. They both are sometimes referred to as the Ahmadis, and that's caused some confusion, but they should be considered completely separate.
And in terms of their general practice, they don't follow the same rules as mainstream Muslims?
Yes, that's right. So because we're in the New Covenant in their teachings, a lot of the practices of Islam are not considered necessary. So they don't follow the five pillars, for instance. They don't practice Friday prayer or any ritual practice around prayer. Instead, prayer is considered a kind of constant conversation with God, more akin to charismatic Christianity, perhaps. They don't observe Ramadan at the same time as other Muslims. They mark it in December because they follow a solar calendar.
So presumably they're considered blasphemous, are they, by a lot of
Muslims? In Islamic majority countries, yes. In Iraq and Iran, they are considered blasphemous and they've had problems. Members who reside there have had problems.
And yes. What is it about the way they're set up? And I mean, I understand they have a sort of communal living model. Is that something that's actually brought them problems?
Yes, that's right. So they, when they moved to the UK, they decided to live communally. They had been doing that in Sweden as well. So here they There was about 150 members living together in Crewe, with around another 150 in the local community in their own homes. And communal living was or is very important to the movement. I should say, as part of the Seventh Covenant, the current age that we're living in, they very strongly believe in the creation of something called the Divine Just State, which is a kind of a perfect kingdom that they're trying to create with Abdullah Hashem as the leader. And the community in Crewe were kind of living as an example or a prototype of this movement.
And I suppose it's this closed nature which can cause problems, isn't it, and safeguarding issues.
Yes, it can do sometimes. A movement can become quite insular, reliant on itself, kind of a little bit cut off from outside society. But I don't know if that was the case in this movement in particular. They're just issues that can arise in communal living groups.
Right, thank you so much, Sarah Harvey from Inform. Well, the time is just after half past seven. Later, we explore whether Muslim and Jewish communities can unite to call out both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Tomorrow, for the first time since the Reformation, the Abbot President of the English Benedictine Order will be speaking in Westminster Abbey. Father Christopher Jameson will deliver a lecture exploring how Benedictine values can guide society through a change of era. But while his message may well be wise, the number of people choosing a monastic life itself is shrinking, not only amongst Catholic orders, but Anglican and Buddhist ones too. Well, to discuss why this is happening and what could be lost, Father Christopher Jameson joins us now. Good morning. Now, Father, you became quite famous with the BBC series The Monastery 20 years ago. People seemed to be excited about what monastic life could offer, but it didn't stop the decline in numbers, did it?
Well, we were not attempting to recruit people through that programme. We were instead trying to offer people sanctuary, which is, of course, a basic human instinct, isn't it, that people want to find time out. And, of course, since that programme aired, in fact, the number of people going on retreat and on pilgrimages has increased. And in that sense, it achieved its aim of trying to offer spirituality to a wider community. And that was taken up quite strongly.
And the church has seen a sort of dramatic collapse before, hasn't it, in monastic life? After all, we had Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries.
Indeed. And that was followed by the French Revolution chasing everybody out of European monasteries too. So, you know, it's been a lot worse. Yes, there is a decline, but we've seen worse.
And you've seen worse, and you think there can then be a revival? I mean, is it addressing a sort of basic societal need?
Well, I think monastic life is based, as I said, on a human instinct, which everybody expresses when they want to seek time out or something like that. But for some people, a very small number, it's an instinct that affects the whole of their lives. And the numbers have dropped. But what's interesting is that the background to this is that, you know, the number of people going to Catholic churches on a Sunday is now about 40% of what it was 40 years ago. So we should expect to see that reflected in entries to monasteries and religious communities. But, of course, there are still some communities that are receiving new members, and a small number are receiving significant numbers. So the decline is not evenly spread.
And do you think it's changing shape? I mean, we've seen a growth in lay movements, people living monastic values without necessarily joining full time. Is that the future, do you think, of a Benedictine life?
Yes, the growth of what's being called in some quarters the new monasticism is very significant. This is lay people mainly who come together either in one place or more normally dispersed to create a community rhythm of prayer and shared life, not living in the same place, but maybe coming together for certain times of the year, or even people in a town coming together each evening to pray, for example, and drawing on the monastic wisdom to help them shape that new kind of community life. It's this intentional desire to pray together and to share life together that finds expression in new forms. And surprisingly, often within evangelical churches, who historically, of course, were very opposed to monasticism. But I'm asked sometimes to go and speak with those groups. And it's very encouraging to see that the monastic wisdom is valued in surprising places. It's almost as if as organized religion, as people call it, declines, people turn to the monastic wisdom to find something. And of course, the paradox is we're the most organized form of religion you can find. You know, a bell goes and we do things. But somehow this particular kind of organized religion has an enduring appeal.
And I wondered, I mean, I know you're speaking tomorrow about how what values you can bring to, so we can all survive this change of era. What does monasticism offer society at the moment?
Well, I think it offers its stability, first of all. This is an era of extraordinary change, and this change affects societies and individual lives and individual families. So the first thing we can offer is a kind of bedrock of stability in life. It's the mindfulness movement that's cashed in on this. But what we say is we offer more than mindfulness. We offer heartfulness. That's to say, mindfulness that is always looking out for other people, not just my own well-being. So I think that fundamental stability is a key part of it. And then secondly, listening, the ability to listen to other people. The first word of the rule of St. Benedict is listen. And in our current situation, there's a lot of shouting and a lot of extremism. And we're saying, please listen, and you'll be surprised by what you hear and surprised to find how much you agree about.
Well, we might be coming to some of that later in the programme. Father Christopher Jameson, thank you very much for joining us.
We're bringing you the anthems and the old school, the rare grooves, the deep cuts and the flat-out bangers that have made UK black music the incredible scene it is today.
Well, that's just a little of the trailer for The Music is Black, an immersive sound exhibition at the new Victoria and Albert East Museum in Stratford, London. The museum has repurposed the archive from its South Kensington parent for a younger audience, and this is its first paid exhibition, taking visitors through 125 years of black music in the UK. The religious and faith roots of this tradition are fundamental, and its lead curator, Jacqueline Springer, explained to me how that influenced her choices.
What I've sought to do in the exhibition, especially in the opening act, is to provide visitors with context as to how Christianity, which was enforced upon trafficked and enslaved African men, women and children, how the very book, the Bible, was later utilised by the enslaved to derive songs of faith in order to provide real sustenance that this was not going to be their sole experience on earth, that God will come and God will save. With the King James Bible, we have a first edition from 1611 on display. And one of the key messages that I invite people to consider on one of those labels is that the very publication used to oppress created the vocal quality for all popular musics, which is the gospel voice. Like, ooh, you can sing. Oh, yes, you can sing. Amen. So whether that's Aretha's voice or whether that's Mary Clayton's voice on Gimme Shelter, that rich sound of pain that some collaborators yearn for, where it comes from, and it comes from a digging into the soul of the oppressed and finding sustenance in the very publication used to oppress. One of the key objects that we have within the section of published texts relating to religion is an Ethiopian Psalter that has been in the collection, in the Victoria and Albert Museum's collection, since the late 1800s. This was acquired by the museum following the Battle of Magdala in 1868. It was looted from Ethiopia. Its presence here in the exhibition affirms the fact that Ethiopia practiced Christianity prior to West African contact by European powers in 1400. But it also allowed me, as a curator for the V&A, to lay bare this relationship with looted objects from colonial conquest. We're travelling through British and international histories. And by the time you get to 1970, which is the core of the exhibition, we're looking at British black music forms that are created here. Prior to that, we're looking at music that comes to the United Kingdom, that's imported, whether that's gospel, whether that's jazz, or whether that's calypso. But from 1970s onward, we're looking at British-based music that's black in its orientation, its inherited ingredients, but it's created on British soil. artists like Sade singing in a very beautiful, soulful voice, but singing against jazz arrangements that are themselves impacted by soul music. We also have house music, which is the music of those who were marginalized from clubland because of their sexual identities and sexual orientations. And then, of course, we have rap, which in itself is an evisceration of society. How it's so valuable that you have artists like Stormzy, a rapper, who will intone about his faith. Lord, I've been broken, although I'm not worthy. And so the biggest takeaway for me curatorially is proving and illustrating those connections historically and contemporaneously, and also having everybody think in the United Kingdom, ooh, these people walk among us. How lucky we are.
And you also feature Brazilian candomblé, don't you? Explain the background to that, and how does it relate to British black music?
One of the terrible facts about transatlantic African chattel enslavement was that more African people were taken to Brazil than any other country. And Brazil was the last country within this network to abolish slavery in 1888. And so that variety of people, they come ready-made with their own cultural and linguistic and faith identities. And that enmeshment of disparate and you know, distinct cultures together creates a solidarity through the experience. And that's what candomblé is. It's a mixture of Catholicism, of West African faiths, and candomblé is now a protected form of faith practice by the United Nations.
And do you explore other faiths in the exhibition? What about Islam?
Yes, we do. And I took a great deal of leadership from my colleagues at the V&A, also those who follow the faith. And I knew that the Quran doesn't have, like the Bible, you know, particular passages that where songs leap out. And so we have chapter 39, verse 53 through to 75, which intones a reassurance to followers that through faith, through the practice of faith, rather, there is always a home and there is always a place of forgiveness for sin.
Jacqueline Springer, and the exhibition at V&A East is on until January next year. Today, in an open letter, leading businesses, different faith groups, as well as charities and sports bodies, have said anti-Semitism is a problem for all of us to fix. This echoes Prime Minister Keir Starmer's speech last week, in which he said tackling anti-Semitism should be the responsibility of every part of society, as he announced funding to strengthen community cohesion. A new YouGov survey claims 63% of Britons see anti-Semitism as a major problem, while just over half of the public say there's a problem with Islamophobia in British society. So is there a new determination by government and by people across faiths to get to grips with the violence and prejudice? Well, I'm joined by Laura Jana Klausner, Rabbi of Bromley Reform Synagogue, and one of the signatories of today's letter, Julie Siddiqui, co-chair of the British Muslim Network. Julie, first of all, why do you, as a Muslim, think it was important to sign today's letter?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, we've seen some terrible things happening over the last couple of months, and I think that it has tipped many people, many more than normal, I would say, to a point of realising, look, we really do have a problem and there's so much more that we can do. And as you see from the letter today, there's a vast array of signatories. And for me, it demonstrates a determination and a positive look at, look, this is a problem for all of us. We can't be making this a problem for Jews. This has to be a problem for all of us in this country. So for me, it felt very important. And I do think that more and more people have recognised now what's been happening and that we have to do something more about it.
OK. And Rabbi Laura, there was also another open letter on Friday by a group of leading Muslims calling for solidarity with Jews. Do you think this kind of initiative will help to reassure the Jewish community?
I think it helps a lot. I am really grateful and I feel very blessed with that. I don't want to be set off. Jews, Muslims, Hindus, we are in this together as a country. And what you said before, that we are lucky to have each other walking alongside each other. You said that, and the last speaker said that. It's completely right. And we've had loads of solidarity. You hear the terrible stuff and you see the terrorism. But most people in Britain just want to live together in a very benign, decent way. And we see that day to day. Yesterday at synagogue, some neighbour, Tony, comes along to me as I'm walking into synagogue. we want you here, we love your contribution, just like other contributions. That is British life.
And Julie, do you think Muslims should be speaking out more? I mean, it's taken a while for this kind of letter to come out, hasn't it? Is it actually quite difficult in communities for people to speak out?
Yeah, look, I think it's difficult for people to understand how this is impacting our Jewish neighbours. I think there's a lot more education that needs to be done. I would often say to people, look, if Laura's congregants are saying they feel fearful going into central London or they are being treated in a discriminatory way at work, we have to listen to that. And in fact, Laura's congregants are saying that because we talk about it. You know, I think sometimes we think, oh, no, it's not as bad as it's. Well, listen to the people. You know, the polling that's been done is interesting because if you ask Jewish people in this country, they would all say, yes, there's a problem. So we have to listen to that voice, which is what I do in my friendships, in my relationships, in my work with people like Rabbi Laura and others. And so, yes, I think Muslims do have a role, as do everybody else. One of the things that we bring out in this letter, that I mention in this letter, is that as Muslims, we know what it feels like to be discriminated against and to be treated in a certain way. And so this idea that we sort of have a hierarchy of hatred, that one's worse than the other, has to stop. We have to come together round the table, learn about each other more, and understand that together, in solidarity, we have to speak up and speak out and walk and do this work together.
Well, Laura, given that Muslims also suffer discrimination and often attacks, should Jewish people be speaking out more about Islamophobia?
100%. There is the instinct of racism and othering that is directed towards Jews, is directed towards Muslims, is directed towards lots of different worlds of racism. This is Jewish racism. We have anti-Muslim racism. And the more we're in solidarity with each other and don't get divided by a proxy war for what's happening in Israel-Palestine, the better.
How would you actually try and bring people together? I mean, after all, somebody who goes and attacks someone in the street, are they going to read this letter? Are they going to be influenced by this letter? How do you actually, in a sense, apart from sitting around a table, you know, you two obviously talk to each other, what about the people that won't be at those kinds of meetings?
No, look, I mean, I went to, after the attack in Golders Green, on the same day, I spoke to Lindsay, my very dear friend. We've known each other a very long time. We've done lots of work together. She's Jewish. I'm Muslim. I said to her, I want to go to Golders Green. So the next day, she and I went to Golders Green and we'd sent a message out to various groups and people, and 150 women showed up with us, and we walked down Golders Green High Street in the heart of the Jewish community in London to the place where it happened. And people on that walk from all backgrounds, Muslim and others, were saying, thank you for doing this and providing us with an opportunity. But you're right, we have to do more. We have to actually get up and do things, not a nice thing to do. We have to have the difficult conversations. But I think that more and more people are realizing that now. And it does have an impact because, of course, those messages get through to the people who might have views that we don't agree with, that might have views that then turn into something bad. Most people, of course, will never, ever do the horrors that we've seen in the synagogue in Manchester and the attacks in Golders Green. The vast majority of people will never do something like that, but they may have views, and we have to continue to do what we can to change those views.
Okay. And Laura, how should the government spend the £1.5 million that's been announced to strengthen community cohesion?
Well, I love the fact that this is not about Jews, it's community cohesion. We've seen that throughout. We have to have, in the education system, in the work system, education towards what does cohesion look like? How do you not avoid the conversations? It's not just conversations of courtesy. You have to feel uncomfortable and you have to have the discussions. And I love the fact that the government is doing this and it's named social cohesion and not this is about Jews, because it's not.
And just briefly, in universities, the government's also talked about campuses having to demonstrate action that they're tackling anti-Semitism. Just very briefly from both of you, do you think that's helpful?
Yeah, and in fact, I sit on a couple of bodies in universities that are doing exactly that about anti-Semitism and other issues. So yes, I absolutely agree. Look, again, if Jewish young people, students, are saying they don't feel safe in university, we have to listen to that and not just dismiss it as over-exaggerating or whatever. We have to listen. And I'm really glad that universities have that. But let's say that universities are doing what they can. The NUS and other bodies are doing what they can, sitting around and trying to work out what more they need to do. So I really welcome that and appreciate them having people like me involved in that work as well.
And Laura?
Yes, I think that there's a system here. I think not all universities are the same at all. And we have some universities who are holding concern about what's happening in Israel-Palestine in one way. And some are not letting that leak out into how students function together. Okay. Let's have debates on university, but they have to be careful.
Right. Thank you so much. I'm sure this dialogue is going to go on and on. Thank you so much, Rabbi Laura Janna-Klausner and Julie Siddiqui. Well, that's it for this week's Sunday. Next week, Julie Etchingham will be in the chair. Simon Earle, by the way, contacted us this morning after hearing our story about working clergy outside the church. He says there's a priest who's a clerk of the scales at Chelmsford Racecourse, weighing jockeys before they go out to ride and when they come back in again. Another unusual secular job. That's it. Goodbye.
Sunday was produced by Bara Arthur Ibrahim and Rebecca Kelly. Now the journalist Afia Hagen makes the Radio 4 We Appeal on behalf of Opportunity International UK.
Amongst the bustling crowds at Agbogbloshie Market in Accra, Ghana's capital, I met market trader Amama. Her stall is nestled amongst hundreds of others, selling fresh produce and cooked foods, the scent of frying oil and spices all around. 31-year-old Amama has a simple setup with just a prep station and a small fryer. Today she's making a sweet, crunchy soybean snack popular in Ghana. On other days, she sells soap and jewellery. She's proud of the business she's built, which has given her freedom. Now she earns enough to provide for her family and send her daughters to school. However, Amama's life has been shaped by early challenges. At 14, she became a mother. Parenthood derailed her education, so at 26, she travelled to find work in Accra, leaving her daughter with her parents. There she found work as a kayaye, a female head porter, common in Ghanaian markets, who carry heavy loads on their heads. Even as we spoke at her stall, I witnessed hundreds of kayaye walking by. They don't get paid much. As a kayaye, Amama could only afford to rent a single room shared with 10 women. Anything spare, she sent home for her daughter. Then she was told about Opportunity International's four-week skills training programme. It's offered to women working as kayaye in Accra. Amama registered and joined a group of 30 women living at a training centre on the city's outskirts. She received a stipend, accommodation and food, and she and her classmates learnt soap making, baking and crafting, skills they could use to set up new businesses. When she graduated 2 years ago, Amama received a startup kit and capital. Today, she's a successful businesswoman, supporting her daughters, and she employs two women. She's passing on the skills she gained to others. Her story shows how one opportunity can change many lives, and you can help today. It costs £500 for a woman to attend Opportunity International's training course. To donate, search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Opportunity International UK and send it to Free Post BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. And please mark the back of your envelope Opportunity International UK. Thank you.
Afia Hagen, the number to call again. 0800 404 8144. Calls are free from landlines and from mobiles. You can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember that if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want Opportunity International UK to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Time now for a weather update. Here's Simon King.
Neil, thanks so much to eat. Yesterday we had a cold front splitting the UK and almost giving us two different seasons. Across northern areas, chillier air and temperatures only 9 Celsius in Durham, whereas to the south of that weather front across southern England, temperatures up to 23 degrees Celsius and feeling more like summer. But for today, we've still got that cold front in place, but it's gradually moving its way south, but introducing the cooler air across southern areas through today. So for southern England into the Midlands and across Wales, it's a mostly cloudy start till Sunday morning. A few showers around the southeast coast, which is going to clear away. But we'll see the cloud breaking up across many areas to bring some sunny spells into the afternoon. Still the possibility of an odd shower, I think, towards Kent and East Sussex this afternoon, and also quite breezy around southern areas today. So it'll make it feel chillier with temperatures about 11 to 15, perhaps up to 16 or 17 degrees in the southwest. Now, for northwest and northeast England, some clear skies this morning. It's been quite chilly. We've had a local frost earlier on this morning across Cumbria. There's going to be lots of sunshine, though, through this morning. We will see a little bit more cloud developing into the afternoon, maximum temperatures of 11 to 13 degrees. And for Northern Ireland and across Scotland, again, it's been pretty chilly this morning. Plenty of sunshine around, though. The cloud will tend to increase here. Some rain will move its way in across northern Scotland. That will turn particularly heavy in the far northeast of Scotland around the Northern Isles into this afternoon. And we'll see maximum temperatures today getting up to about 9 to 14 degrees Celsius. Neil, back to you.
Many thanks, Simon King. Now with a look ahead to Broadcasting House at 9 o'clock. Good morning, Paddy O'Connell.
Good morning, Neil Nunes, and hello, good morning to you. Well, the UK theme returns to Radio 4 at 9. The wake-up call was cruelly axed some years ago, but we're using it to travel round the home nations to talk about the elections. One Labour MP has issued an ultimatum to the Cabinet, speaking on PM here on Radio 4. She's warning she'll trigger a leadership contest tomorrow if they don't. Our live guest will be Labour grandee Lord Blunkett. The Observer reports two investigations are underway into the declared £5 million donation to Nigel Farage. The paper's editor, James Harding, joins our editor special along with Chloe Hubbard of The Mirror and Michael Booker of GB News. Plus, I learn a mollusk-based insult from Essex Man.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday the 10th of May. Good morning, this is Alan Smith. Sir Keir Starmer has said he wants to be Prime Minister for a decade as he prepares to mount a fight back against growing calls for a change in Number 10. The cruise ship at the centre of a fatal outbreak of Hunter virus has arrived in Tenerife, where those on board will be evacuated. Religious and business leaders have signed an open letter in support of the UK's Jewish community. Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he will lead Labour into the next general election, despite growing calls for him to step aside after the party's drubbing in polls across England, Scotland and Wales. He's told the Observer newspaper that last week's results were very tough, but that his government was a 10-year project of renewal. The Prime Minister will use a speech tomorrow to try to win back support, but he could also face a challenge to his leadership. Here's our political correspondent Ian Watson.
The Prime Minister wants to get on the front foot after last Thursday's dismal electoral performance. He'll draw bold dividing lines with Reform UK by saying he won't hold back from seeking closer ties to Brussels, and that he expects to launch a scheme to allow young EU citizens to work temporarily in the UK and vice versa next year. He'll have to convince an increasingly sceptical Labour Party that he has the ideas and ability to improve its historically low poll ratings. Tomorrow is also the deadline set by the former minister Catherine West for leadership challenges to Sir Keir to step up, otherwise she'll launch her own bid. Some MPs on the party's centre-left have tried, so far unsuccessfully, to persuade her to ditch her plan because they would rather Sir Keir occupied Number 10 temporarily until the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham can return to Westminster at a by-election. But Sir Keir has no intention of departing either abruptly or via an orderly transition. He told the Observer newspaper he intends to lead his party into the next election and would be willing to serve a second term as Prime Minister.
A cruise ship hit by a deadly outbreak of Hunter virus has arrived at the Spanish island of Tenerife, where those on board will be allowed to disembark. The 22 British passengers and staff will be tested and taken back to the UK. Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports from Tenerife.
After weeks at sea, the Hondius entered the port here in Tenerife before dawn. When sun rose, it revealed the cruise liner anchored offshore, with military police boats on patrol and medics and officials on land poised to launch a complex operation. This morning, some will board the Hondius and check for any symptoms of the hantavirus. Then passengers and some crew will be ferried to land in small groups and taken onto charter flights on standby at the airport. This whole operation has been planned meticulously, involving more than two dozen countries. The head of the World Health Organization, who's here supervising, has again stressed that the risk to the general population is low. The virus is carried by rodents and it's not normally transmitted between people. But three passengers died on the cruise liner and several have been infected. So the isolation unit of a local hospital is ready should anyone else fall seriously ill.
Officials on the remote Atlantic island of Tristan da Cunha say the UK military has parachuted medics and supplies to help treat a suspected hantavirus patient. The MV Hondius stopped at the British territory last month. The island, which is home to about 220 people, doesn't have an airport. Eight military personnel were instead dropped onto a golf course. Officials in Lebanon say 39 people were killed yesterday in a series of strikes by the Israeli military. Hezbollah said it responded by launching rockets and drones into northern Israel. Israeli forces and Hezbollah have continued to trade fire since President Trump announced a ceasefire deal between the governments of Israel and Lebanon last month. Our Middle East correspondent Wira Davis reports from Jerusalem.
This is a ceasefire in name only. Almost every day since it began in mid-April, Israel has attacked what it says are Hezbollah positions that, according to the IDF, pose an imminent threat to its soldiers and civilians. In the latest strikes, Israel says it hit more than 85 targets, mainly in southern Lebanon, but also in the eastern Bekaa Valley. But many civilians, including very young children, have been killed in the Israeli attacks, including families who had already been displaced by the war. In the southern town of Saksiye, at least seven people were killed, said the Lebanese health ministry.
The Saudi oil giant Aramco has reported a 25% rise in net profits in the first 3 months of the year, despite the war in the Middle East effectively choking off the Strait of Hormuz. The company, which is the world's largest oil exporter, said net profits reached $32.5 billion. The firm said it had benefited from higher oil prices and its east-west pipeline that circumvents the strait and helped to mitigate the impact of a global energy shock. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has said he thinks the conflict with Ukraine is coming to an end. He made the comment as he spoke to reporters in the Kremlin after Russia held its most scaled-back Victory Day parade in years. But Mr. Putin said he would only meet his Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky once a lasting peace deal was agreed. Leaders of business organisations and religious groups have signed a letter telling the British Jewish community that they will do everything they can to protect it from anti-Semitism. Their commitment is a response to a number of attacks on British Jews and Jewish sites in recent weeks. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning reports.
Anti-Semitism is not a problem for Jewish people to have to respond to, says the letter. This is a problem for all of us to fix. The letter has been signed by religious leaders from the Muslim, Christian, Sikh and Hindu communities, by the Confederation of British Industry, the Football Association, Universities UK, ITV, The Guardian, the Local Government Association and others. The Chief Rabbi, Sir Ephraim Mervis, said it was heartening to see so many stand against anti-Jewish hatred.
The British boxer Daniel Dubois has won the WBO World Heavyweight title after beating his fellow Briton Fabio Wardley in Manchester. Dubois was knocked down twice during the fight but recovered to stop his opponent in the 11th round of a brutal encounter. This was the moment the contest ended, as described by Ronald McIntosh on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Oh, another left right, followed by a left hook, and another thunderous left hook in the neutral corner on the near side of the ring. And Howard Foster steps in to stop the onslaught. Fabio Wardley defeated for the first time as a professional. The man stubbornly refused to go down. And there is absolute pandemonium in the boxing ring because Daniel Dubois inflicts the first defeat onto the previously undefeated record of Fabio Wardley.
That's the BBC News. Now for a look at the Sunday papers, and almost all focus on the Prime Minister's future. The Sunday Telegraph calls the Labour MP Catherine West's threat to launch a leadership challenge a stalking horse plot to oust Starmer. One serving minister tells the paper she would probably gain the backing of the 81 MPs needed to prompt a contest. If Starmer had a plot, he's lost it, is the Mail on Sunday's headline. The Sunday Mirror says Sir Keir is planning to slash energy bills in a bid to turn around his party's fortunes. The Sun on Sunday calls the Prime Minister's decision to bring Gordon Brown and Harriet Harman back into government a desperate bid to save his skin. The Sunday Times says the move failed to quell a growing backbench revolt. The paper's front page cartoon shows a stuffed dodo saying, if Gordon Brown can make a comeback, there's hope for us all. God help us all, declares the Daily Star Sunday on its front page. Sir Keir's used an interview with The Observer to vow that he will stay on and fight the next general election. In it, he says he has a strong belief that there aren't many people who actually want Zach Polanski or Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. But Mr Farage tells the Sunday Express the economic and social consequences for the country don't bear thinking about if Sir Keir stays on until 2029. The Observer says Mr Farage could face a recall petition and by-election over a £5 million donation he received from a cryptocurrency tycoon before he became an MP. It says he may face investigations by the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner and the Electoral Commission. The paper says it understands the elections regulator will decide whether to start its probe as early as this week. Reform UK says it complied with all the relevant rules, and Mr Farage has told the Mail the donation was legal and used to fund his security. The editorial sections have differing views about whether Sir Keir Starmer should stay on as Prime Minister. The Telegraph says he should enact a final U-turn and resign. The Mail says whoever seeks to succeed Sir Keir will first need to drag him out of number 10. But the Mirror says toppling the PM now would cause chaos and instead argues for him to change his approach. The Observer also cautions against a leadership contest. It says Sir Keir is no storyteller and could make We Will Fight Them on the Beaches sound like a mortgage application. But it argues attempting to change prime ministers now would only signal national instability. And that's our look at the Sunday papers.
Many thanks, Alan Smith. In this morning's Witness History, we go back to 1960 to what's believed to be the only time Elvis Presley set foot on British soil. Witness History is in 40 minutes from now. Now on BBC Radio 4 in this week's Sunday Worship from Northern Ireland, Professor John Lennox reflects on the relationship between faith and science in conversation with Andrew Roycroft, who introduces the service.
Welcome to Sunday Worship. Today we're meditating together on how science, faith, wonder and worship fit together in Christianity. We live in a world that is beset by wonders all around us. Beauty, immensity and diversity that can leave us wide-eyed and breathless. Whether it is the mind-blowing vastness of space, the intricacy of cellular life or the vibrant biological mosaic of the natural world, there is so much to grab our attention and stir our imagination. As scientific understanding of our world advances, how can those who hold to Christian theism still find space for their faith? And how can the wonders of the world feed our worship of God? I am joined today by Professor John Lennox. John Lennox is an Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at University of Oxford, Emeritus Fellow in Mathematics and Philosophy of Science in Green Templeton College, Oxford, and president of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. He is on record as saying that faith is a response to evidence, not a rejoicing in the absence of evidence. In that spirit, our conversation today dwells on the evidence that the natural world presents to us, and how wonder is fueled by the facts of this phenomenal world in which we live. This service is designed to feed our faith and stir wonder and worship in the hearts of all who listen to it.
Creation sings the Father's song. He calls the sun to wake the dawn and run the course of day till evening falls in crimson rays. His fingerprints in flakes of snow, his breath upon the spinning globe. He charts the eagle's flight, commands the newborn baby's cry. Ageless one in times that breaks, unveil the Father's plan of reconciling God and man. A second Adam walked the earth, whose blameless life would break the curse, whose death would set us free to live with Him eternally. When Christ shall reign upon the earth, the bitter wars, the rage, are birth pains of a coming age. When He renews the land and sky, all heaven will sing and earth reply with one resplendent theme, the glory of our God and
Almighty God, we exalt and worship You as our Creator, our Sustainer, the Lord of life, Giver of every good thing. We magnify You for the wonders of our world and the capacities You have given to us to observe. Help us as we marvel at the scale of the universe to rejoice in the scope of Your love. Aid us as we observe the work of Your hands to perceive the concern of Your heart, that we might know You, receive You through Your Son, and live for You. May our service today bring great praise to Your name, and may our contemplation of who You are and what You have done remind us of who we are and the place You have given to us in Your world. We ask this in the name of Your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
O Lord my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the works thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Forest glades I wander and hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees. When I look down from lofty mountain grandeur and see the blue and feel the gentle, then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, oh, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art. God, his Son, not sparing, sent him to die. I scarce can take it in that on the cross, my burden gladly bearing, he bled and died to take away. Sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art. Then sings my soul, my Savior God, to thee. How great thou art, how great thou art.
Professor Lennox, in our conversation today, we are considering creation and its manifold beauty and thinking through how looking beneath the surface, mining the discoveries of science, can act as a fuel for faith in God rather than as a foil to it. We will be isolating some specific aspects of the cosmos for consideration later on. But broadly, as a man of faith and a man of science, how has your study of the universe informed your worship?
The expression man of faith and man of science can sometimes give the impression that faith is not involved in science and the rational approach of science is not involved in faith in God. Both of these are actually false, because there is, in fact, a close connection between science and faith in God. For instance, the motor that drove the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th centuries through men like Galileo, Kepler and Newton was their faith in God as creator. For instance, the driving force behind Galileo's questing mind was his deep inner conviction that the Creator, who, quote, had endowed us with senses, reason and intellect, intended us not to forgo their use, and by some other means to give us knowledge, which we can attain by them. Such discovery for Johannes Kepler amounted, in his famous phrase, to saying, I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God. And it's the same for me. And the first thing that leads me to worship God is the fact that science can be done. Or, to put it more precisely, that the workings of the universe are describable in the language of mathematics, whereas the workings of the biosphere are describable in the language of genetics. Wonderful circumstances that tell me that this is a word-based universe. These facts resonate deeply with the opening statement of the fourth gospel. In the beginning was the Word. All things came to be through him. So the very languages of science lead me to worship God as the Creator Word.
Our worship today is structured around Psalm 8, a poem that invites us to marvel at wonders above us, wonders within us as human beings, and wonders around us in the beauty of the natural world we are called to steward and cultivate. The first four verses of the psalm focus our mind on wonders above, the immensity of the heavens.
Lord, our Lord, how magnificent is your name throughout the earth. You have covered the heavens with your majesty. From the mouths of infants and nursing babies, you have established a stronghold on account of your adversaries, in order to silence the enemy and the avenger. When I observe your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is a human being that you remember him, a son of man that you look after him?
This creation psalm begins by looking up into the heavens and magnifying God for what we can observe in the skies. The second decade of the 21st century finds humanity gazing above in new ways, with the recent Artemis II mission putting the moon in full focus again. Professor Lennox, one of your hobbies for many decades has been amateur astronomy. What captivates you about the heavens, and how can astronomy and astrophysics enrich our reading of Psalm 8 and of the Christian faith? Can you describe some of the emotions that attend gazing into the heavens for you?
The first scientist I ever had a discussion with was Dr. Eric Lindsay, director of the observatory in my hometown, Armagh. As schoolboy at the time, I asked him what his astronomy told him about the big question of what, if anything, was behind the universe. He told me that one cannot look up into the starry sky night after night without sensing that there is a mind behind it. And later in life, I got a good telescope of my own and began fully to appreciate the awesome beauty and the vast size and age of the universe. Looking at the fuzzy ball of stars that is our nearest galaxy, Andromeda, M31, 2.5 million light years away from us, containing something like a mind-numbing trillion stars. Or catching sight of the wonderful colours of the much nearer Ring Nebula, M57, 2,000 light-years away, it makes my mind and heart sing with the psalmist that the heavens really do declare the glory of God.
And one phenomenon that the Artemis II crew is facing, in common with the Apollo missions of another generation, is the overview effect, the emotional, psychological and spiritual impact of having viewed the entire planet. Thinking back to 1972, when the blue marble picture first entered our shared consciousness, what impact did that photo have on you, and how does that picture frame our place in the universe?
I remember that photograph very well in 1972, and I found it quite stunning. It shows us how small we humans are as we whirl through space on our beautiful blue planet, and it should produce in us a healthy humility. However, size is not necessarily the measure of value. A diamond is worth a lot more than a lump of coal, although they are essentially the same stuff. And Psalm 8 points out that God is mindful of us. And it is the fact that we humans have been specially made in his image that gives us dignity. The heavens show God's glory, but they were not made in his image. We were. And it is that awesome fact from which our true value derives and which determines our place in the universe.
And words to his design. The one new manger's host revealed hung the stars like chandeliers, numbered every grain of sand.
The nature of being human has captured the minds of philosophers and the hearts of poets across history. Arquidity, the riddle and rhapsody of human life, is intriguing, beguiling, and ultimately confounding. In Hamlet, William Shakespeare put the following lines on the lips of his main protagonist. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. Many centuries earlier, the psalmist David made the majestic dignity of human life the core of his praise to God for creation. His writing invites us to rejoice at wonders within, the intricacy and purpose of our given life as people.
When I observe your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is a human being that you remember him, a son of man that you look after him? You made him little less than God and crowned him with glory and honour.
In the early 21st century, we are grappling in new ways with what humanness is. The unstinting march of artificial intelligence into our daily lives, coupled with the wonders and warnings that scientific and engineering worlds bring to our attention with increasing frequency, is giving us fresh pause to think about what a person is. Professor Lennox, David asks in Psalm 8 verse 4, what is a human being? Does his answer satisfy you? If so, why?
Yes. I not only find it satisfying but challenging. David says three things about human beings in this text. Firstly, that they were created a little lower than the heavenly beings, which presumably means that human beings are not pure spirit as God and angels are, but are part spirit and part animal. Yet, secondly, they are crowned with glory and honour, which I take to imply that they were made in the image of God, as we have just discussed. Thirdly, God has given them genuine authority and responsibility as stewards of his creation to develop it and care for it, for its ultimate owner, God himself.
In your writing on AI, you have described human beings as having a material base, an aesthetic sense, innate curiosity, as well as possessing sophisticated high-level language. How do these remarkable features of human identity move you to worship?
Apart from having a material base as machines do, humans are distinct from AIs because they are living beings, which AIs are not. They are conscious of the world and other humans around them, which AIs are not. They have an aesthetic sense, which AIs do not. They are moral beings, which AIs are not. And they have language that enables them to communicate with each other and with God. In short, they are made in the image of God with the capacity to know and worship God, which AIs are not.
And in a world, as you've described it, that seeks to uncouple intelligence from consciousness, how is gathering for worship and fellowship an act of cultural resistance?
That's a very interesting idea. Gathering for worship implies that we are conscious of a need for friendship and fellowship, and the communal worship of God resists the secular pressure to find our meaning and value in this world, and it reinforces the overarching truth that there is a God whose world we inhabit and whose people form a community of worship and witness to their Redeemer, Lord and King Jesus Christ. The existence of such a community is a challenge to the naturalism that tends to dominate Western culture, and which, I am glad to say, is challenging a new generation to think again.
And how does God taking flesh in the person of Jesus Christ transform our worship of him through Psalm 8?
That Jesus Christ is God incarnate is the central claim of Christianity. The Word, who is the Creator God, who never came to be flesh and dwelt among us. This is the ultimate, stunning answer to the question of Psalm 8, what is man? The answer is that human beings are so made that God could become one, and he did. The transhumanist Homo Deus agenda is that our salvation will come through bioengineering and merging with machines to become superintelligent gods. The Christian good news is the polar opposite of this, that we can have salvation as a free gift of God's grace because God has become man to effect that salvation and bring us back to himself. Those who acknowledge that they have failed to live as they should, repent of it, and receive Jesus as the Saviour who died for them, find forgiveness, peace with God, and the gift of a power to live for him. This is what has made my life what it has been and is. It is Christ who has given me a sure hope for the world to come that is not based on my merit, but on what he has accomplished. Following him as the Creator and light of the world has filled my life with meaning and worship, and has been my greatest joy.
Things bright.
Psalm 8 ends by widening its lens, allowing the reader and singer to see the world in which human beings have been placed, encouraging us to bear witness to the wonders around us, to take stock of the beauty of the earth, and to own the stewardship of the earth that is part of being human.
You made him a little less than God, and crowned him with glory and honour. You made him ruler over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, all the sheep and oxen, as well as the animals in the wild, the birds of the sky, and the fish of the sea that pass through the currents of the seas. Lord, our Lord, how magnificent is your name throughout the earth.
The poet Jared Manley Hopkins captured something of the wonders around us when he wrote, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God, and generations of poets and ordinary people have stood in awe of the beauty and diversity of this planet." How does scientific endeavour and research enrich that sense of wonder, Professor Lennox?
According to Genesis, one of the tasks God gave to the first humans was to name the animals. This activity, we call it taxonomy, is one of the fundamental academic disciplines. And in the deepest sense, naming things involves getting to know them intimately, what they are made of, how they function. And anyone who has watched a David Attenborough wildlife documentary will know some of the wonders that this process can reveal in the nature that surrounds us, even in a garden.
Beauty and diversity bring responsibility to steward the natural resources of the world in a way that honours God and cares for his creation. From cultivating our gardens to caring about the climate, how can working the soil and engaging in husbandry magnify the name of the God who gives us all things?
The first way is simply because God gave the first humans such things to do. One of the key teachings of the New Testament is that all of our work, and not only our specifically religious activity, can be done unto the Lord. Paul wrote, "Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters." And the poet John Keble grasped this when he wrote the famous lines, "The trivial round, the common task, will furnish all we ought to ask, room to deny ourselves, a road to bring us daily nearer God." Sadly, we often measure our work in material terms of food, clothing and housing. These things, though important, are intended by God as the byproducts of our work, not its goal. According to Christ himself, the goal of work should be to seek God and his righteousness. Which attitude can transform all work, however humble, into an experience of the living God himself?
Earlier in our service, we referenced the work of Jared Manley Hopkins. Just now, we will hear his poem, Pied Beauty, read by Sandra McCracken.
Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a branded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim. He fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him.
Thank you. Almighty God, maker of heaven and earth, we bless you for the beauty, diversity, and complexity of this world in which you've placed us. Thank you for the vast splendour of the heavens, the deep dignity of our nature as human beings, and the glorious colours and textures of the natural world. Thank you for entrusting us with the care and keeping of the earth, and help us to be faithful in our stewardship of resources and our treatment of one another. We pray for those engaged in research across our world. Give them ever greater insight into the things that you have made and the ways in which you provided for our well-being and flourishing as people. We pray for all in authority over us, locally, nationally, and on a world stage. May their conduct of office bear the givenness of this world in mind at all times, and may policymakers always see the good of people and society as their goal. Help us to rejoice in the world you have made today and every day. Help us to care for creation, to cultivate beauty in our own lives, and to live with generosity towards others. We ask all of this in the name of your Son who walked this earth, endured the cross, ascended into heaven, and is coming again, Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you for joining us this morning as we have meditated on faith, science, wonder, and worship. What a universe our planet is part of. What a world of wonder there is in being human. What joy there is in the tender tillage of the earth, and how all of these things move us to worship the God who gave them. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all, now and forevermore. Amen.
For the beauty of the earth, for the beauty of the skies, for the love which from
Sunday worship with Professor John Lennox and Andrew Roycroft came from Northern Ireland and was produced by David Walker. Next week on the Sunday after Ascension, Sunday worship will be at the Hudinot Hall in Cardiff, the home of the National Chorus of Wales, who will lead the music in a service on the theme Risen, Ascended, Glorified. We recall the King of Rock and Roll's unexpected visit to Scotland in just a moment.
On BBC Sounds, there are podcasts to help you look after your body
and your mind.
From increasing your immunity
to feeling more confident.
Or tips on how to focus.
Sorry, what were you saying?
If it matters to you, it matters to us.
Feel good inside and out.
With What's Up Docs
and Complex with Kimberly Wilson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The acclaimed actor David Morrissey shares the soundtrack of his life with Lauren Laverne. That's on Desert Island Discs later this morning at 10 o'clock. And when we head over to Ambridge at 11, Ruth has a lot to think about and Brian fears the worst. Now, history told about the people who were there. It's Witness History with Megan Jones and the story of a short but memorable visit.
I thought I was dreaming all this. I thought it was a dream. And it wasn't a dream, it was reality. And to think he was impressed with my hometown.
It's the 2nd of March 1960. We're in Prestwick, a small town on the west coast of Scotland. Its airport, which also stretches into the village of Monkton, is used by the United States Air Force as a military base.
When the Americans were here, they brought a lot of money into Prestwick. Prestwick's a very friendly wee town, it really is.
This is where 16-year-old Anne Murphy lives. By day, she works just down the road as an office girl at a solicitor's firm.
We didn't have a phone. My mum had to run down to the telephone box and phone me just at 10 to 5. I finished at 5. And she said, "That's Sergeant Phelps, who I used to babysit for. It's just been at the door, Anne. Elvis is arriving between 6 and 7 tonight. So don't linger after you finish your work to go to the shops."
Anne doesn't question it. She trusts Sergeant Phelps. And anyway, for her, Elvis isn't just a rock and roll star.
He was my first boyfriend. The earliest memory of Elvis was when he was on the radio and he was singing "I'm All Shook Up." I thought, good grief, what is this, you know? Well, I said, I'll have to get a photograph of him. How am I going to get a photograph of him? Because we hadn't seen a photograph of him.
I'm all shook up.
By 1958, Elvis Presley was an international sensation.
I just loved his looks. He was really handsome. I loved the music. Going through a party in the county jail. I just loved all of them, really, you know. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing.
You should have heard his knocked-out jailbird sing. At the height of his fame at age 23, he was inducted into the US Army at the Memphis Draft Board.
The rock and roll king was about to embark for foreign service, 18 months in Germany. How the army would stand the impact of Mr. Presley was a big question months ago.
Almost 2 years later, Elvis is promoted to sergeant.
Everybody thought I wouldn't have to work and I would be given special treatment and this and that. But when they looked around and saw that I was pulling guard and everything just like they were, well, they figured, well, he's just like us.
On March the 2nd, 1960, at 5:25 p.m., Elvis leaves Frankfurt in Germany, heading to New Jersey in the United States. The military plane can't make the journey in one go, though. It needs to refuel, so heads for Scotland, where word is already spreading Elvis is on his way.
I ran up the road, had my tea, and I got my mother's bike out. I asked her if it was all right. She says yes. I was cycling away and I spotted my friend, and my friend said, "Where are you going?" I says, "I'm going to see Elvis," and she laughed. She says, "Can I come?" So I gave her a backseater and we fell off the bike.
Anne and her friend Muriel abandon the bike, deciding to run to the American base instead, telling everyone they pass where they're going.
"Going to see Elvis." They just laughed. They said, "Oh, that's a rumour."
Anne doesn't stop until she reaches the runway, which is also a road.
So when a flight was coming into Prestwick over the sea, there was traffic lights so that the traffic couldn't get over the road until the aeroplane landed, because the road was part of the runway. We ran across that. I mean, you shouldn't have done it.
They see a plane already parked. Doors open, steps down. Military police, or MPs, are standing guard.
And we got there, and the crowds of people that were there. And we were small. I mean, I was 15, but I was small. Still am small. And the MPs said, "Oh, you're out of breath, you young ones." And I said to the MPs who was at the gates, "Have we missed him? Have we missed Elvis?" He says, "No, but he's just ready to come out." He ushered us into the front of the barrier and he says, "No touching Elvis, no talking to him."
Anne is standing right at the bottom of the steps of the plane. She looks up and there is Elvis Presley, her boyfriend, but also a 25-year-old US Army sergeant wearing his khaki green uniform and service cap.
Well, he looked handsome. He always did look handsome to me. I thought I was dreaming. And the cheers he got when he stepped out of the aeroplane onto the steps. And he shouted, "Where am I?" And we all shouted, "Prestwick!" and I couldn't believe they actually came down to the barrier where I was standing with other girls. I was so close to him. He had beautiful skin, lovely skin, beautiful teeth. I was in awe with him. I couldn't believe that Elvis was standing next to me. I couldn't believe that. I was in shock. I was looking up at him, you know, I mean, I was speechless. I couldn't believe that this Elvis was in front of me.
He signs autographs and, without his usual entourage around him, he's reportedly relaxed, happy to shake hands, pose for photos and chat to his fans.
He said he would be back, but he never came back.
Then, just like that, Anne's dream is over. Elvis is hurried away into a waiting car bound for the nearby officer's mess. But not before Anne's friend Muriel seizes one last chance to see him.
The commander's car was actually parked at the aeroplane, and my friend jumped a barrier and spread-eagled herself onto the bonnet of the car and looked in the windows at Elvis getting driven away.
Muriel was moved off the car, and the fans are then ushered out the airport.
We skipped, we sang, we were so happy going down the road, running round the road and getting across the runway again, which we shouldn't have done, but there again we did it. And went into the Central Cafe in Prestwick. They had a jukebox and they had a Coca-Cola machine, and you put a shilling in and you got a bottle of Coca-Cola chilled. It was dead American. Step on my blue suede shoe. I was all shook up.
The next day, for anyone who still thought it was just a rumour, Elvis's visit makes the local newspapers.
Hundreds of screaming teenagers drowned out the noise of jet engines when Sergeant Elvis the Pelvis Presley flew into Prestwick last night.
Sergeant Presley stepped from the aircraft to the chants of "We want Elvis" from the fans lining the barricades.
When told he was in Scotland, the 25-year-old rock and roll star said, "Now that is one country I've never been in before."
After a brief press conference, he was escorted to rub shoulders with fellow sergeants before flying home. The stay at Prestwick lasted for an hour.
There's even a photograph of Anne. Her mouth is wide open like she's in shock.
I'm looking up at him adoringly, I would say, you know, and smiling. And he's chatting to the other girls, but I'm so close to him.
More than 65 years on, despite him never coming back, Elvis has never really left her.
I've got Elvis in every room, even in the bathroom. I've got him. And he's shaking his legs every time, you know, the minutes go forward, he shakes his leg. I've got him in every room.
When the king of rock and roll was briefly in Scotland, that was Witness History presented by Megan Jones. And for more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Looking ahead here on Radio 4, Paddy O'Connell will be along shortly with Broadcasting House. That's in a couple of minutes. And later at 15:15, we profile the TV chef, author and campaigner, Jamie Oliver. Now, Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton. The spotted flycatcher has been chosen for today's tweet by the Springwatch ornithologist Jack Badhams.
Look, let's be honest. This must be one of the dullest bird songs of all time. But for me, it's one I love, for it signals the presence of one of my favourite birds, the spotted flycatcher. OK, they might not be the most stunning bird to look at either, various shades of brown streaking across their front, and ironically, not a spot to be found. But it's their behaviour that draws me to them. Sitting prominently on a perch to sally out into the air and snatch an insect deftly on the wing. They might not be spotted, but they're called flycatchers for good reason. I remember chancing upon my first spotted flycatcher nest at Creswell Crags, a limestone gorge on the Derbyshire-Nottinghamshire border, very close to where I live. I was hooked on them after that. I spent hours tracking down their nests over the next few years, peering in briefly to count the eggs and chicks to keep track of their breeding success. By fitting the adult birds with coloured rings, I could identify who was paired with who and see who returned safely back from Africa. Then,